You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Given the importance that's attributed to the CIA as being so important that it has to remain secret, and so important that if you talk about it, you can go to jail. Everything it's done is so important, and yet nobody knows anything about these things. And there, and that is the result of 70 years of fake news. Americans have no understanding of what their government truly is, because they don't know what the CIA has done. They don't know about how evil the people who serve in Congress and the bureaucracies truly are, because all these evil, illegal things are done by the CIA, and the CIA has absolute immunity.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Douglas Valentine. Today's show, The Deep State as Fake News. Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, about the CIA in Vietnam, and The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology, With Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. Today we discuss his latest book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Doug Valentine, good to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me on your show.
William Colby gave you unprecedented access to interview CIA officers in order to write your book on the Phoenix program in Vietnam. Your new book is The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Why did you title your book The CIA as Organized Crime?
Because everything that the CIA does basically is illegal. And I think of them as the organized crime branch of the United States government. And it's interesting because there's a sort of moral tinge to the title, you know, as if doing something illegal is universally agreed upon as, you know, like a bad thing to do. And I should add that where you enter into a murky moral realm, and I'm not one to defend the CIA, but everybody does illegal things. You know, I mean, I smoked pot for 45 years before it became legal here in the state of Massachusetts. And, you know, all that time, somebody could have, you know, written my biography and called it Doug Valentine as the criminal. You know, I mean, and people do all sorts of illegal things, but it's the extent that of the CIA's illegal actions and it's their impact that make the CIA really a good target of anybody's moral outrage. At the same time, all these things, the CIA does these things illegally because it feels that the American public wants these things done. It just doesn't want to hear about them. Just like Congress authorizes everything that the CIA does. Nothing that the CIA is not a rogue enterprise that is engaging in all these kind of illegal activities, which I chronicle and categorize in excruciating detail in the book. Everything from drug trafficking and arms trafficking to overthrowing foreign governments, to spying on people, to burglaries, to extortion, blackmail, any kind of crime at all, they engage in on a massive industrial scale. But Congress doesn't want to hear about it. And in fact, Congress has very gratefully passed lots of laws that make it illegal for anybody to blow the whistle. on the CIA's crimes. And the media, through its arrangements with the CIA, does everything it can to cover up the crimes and not tell you about them, on the assumption that the public is too sensitive to know about these things, or that it's in government engages in these kind of industrial scale illegal activities, which are said to never affect America, that these illegal things that they engage in are too horrible for you to know about, and if you knew about them, it would upset you. So you're not told about them, and you're told that none of this affects you personally, that all these illegal things that are being done overseas, for example, and they're being done for your benefit. Well, that's a really big lie, and it's hard to disprove it if you can't actually document all these illegal things that the CIA is engaged in, because there's laws against talking about them. There's laws against naming CIA officers. If you name a CIA officer, you can go to jail. If you talk about CIA sources and methods, you can go to jail. So, before the laws were passed in 1982, making it illegal to name CIA officers, there was still an agreement between the media and the CIA that they wouldn't talk about it, so that these illegal operations could continue and go on all the time. But we've entered a new phase, which is sort of symbolized by the election of Donald Trump and now the discussion of what's called fake news, which is sort of characterized as a new development, as if there hadn't always been fake news. But what I've been telling you for the last 10 minutes here is that Americans have been subject to fake news throughout steadily and relentlessly, without any interruption, since the CIA was created. Very infrequently do we learn anything about the CIA, and then we only learn about it ex post facto, when something happens that has to be discussed, and then only in the most vague and general ways, without, again, ever naming any particular CIA officer or explaining anything about their sources and methods. So in this sense, given the importance that's attributed to the CIA as being so important that it has to remain secret, and so important that if you talk about it, you can go to jail. Everything it's done is so important, and yet nobody knows anything about these things. And that is the result of 70 years of fake news. And now we're told some, you know, fake news of the media covering up everything that the CIA has done. Americans have no understanding of what their government truly is, because they don't know what the CIA has done. They don't know about how evil the people who serve in Congress and the bureaucracies truly are, because all these evil, illegal things are done by the CIA, and the CIA has absolute immunity. But it all comes back to us, and it has finally erupted with the election of Donald Trump and this new controversy about fake news, as somehow Americans are now going to confront their secret past and the fact that they've been lied to for 70 years, and everything that used to be hidden is now going to be exposed, and we're going to stand up and look in the mirror and see ourselves for exactly what they are. Well, I got news for you. That ain't going to happen. It's still going on, and as much as people talk about fake news, that in itself is fake. We still haven't gotten anywhere near to an honest, open discussion about what the CIA does, and if it really was doing things that were for our benefit and helped us, then we would be able to talk about it. And if it was only the kind of illegal things that, like me smoking pot for a couple of decades, that really were not harming anybody, then what would be the problem in talking about it? But the mere fact that it is illegal to talk about it, and it is never talked about it, is proof that it is devastatingly awful. And all that devastatingly awfulness, which has been hidden from us for 70 years, affects us in countless ways, not least of which is robbing us of our history and our identity. everything that the CIA does comes home to haunt us, most especially in the fact that it's secret from us and we don't know what it is.
How did your book, The CIA as Organized Crime, evolve from your study of the Phoenix program, or did it?
Well, yeah, it did a lot. And Phoenix is an important thing to understand if you want to understand the CIA, and not only the CIA, but how the security systems of the government function in secret, and how, again, these secret operations affect you in ways that you don't understand, and how these secret operations affect, actually define most people's basic assumptions about what America is and what it represents and what it symbolizes, and they affect people's self-concepts as individuals. After 70 years of living in a world of illusion and raising children to believe these illusions, you know, it's actually integral to our self-concepts and all our basic assumptions. And the Phoenix program, which I had, you know, this unusual access to, provides a keyhole. It is a system which I was able to document from beginning to end, from its operational realities to its stated objectives, from the very lowest levels to the very highest levels, to show how CIA policy is created, how it's dissembled in front of Congress and the public, and how it really affects people in terms of it being Phoenix being the ultimate system for providing security for the rich political elite in this country, and how Phoenix becomes the model for not only fighting the war on terror, but for the Department of Homeland Security. And as soon as you have a political figure like Donald Trump, who's willing to pull out all the stops, you can actually, through this kind of Phoenix system that's set up, you can coordinate mass deportations. You can coordinate the prevention of an entire religious class from entering the United States. You can harass it indefinitely. And the security forces which are in place in the Department of Homeland Security are happy to do this. This is what they've been indoctrinated and trained to do, and this is what they've been waiting to do. And as soon as the political climate wants to do it, it can be done, because these systems like Phoenix program, which is a system, and I explain at length in the book what I mean by system. You know, it's something that's organized and managed, and it has rules and regulations, and it's very cleverly thought out by people who are magna cum laude graduates of Yale University, very intelligent people, put these systems in place. And how those systems, once a political figure like Donald Trump comes along, can be manipulated and used and turned against you. Phoenix was created by the CIA in Vietnam to use to suppress the insurgency there, and not only the insurgency there, but any domestic nationalistic opposition to the puppet government there. And now it's the model for the Department of Homeland Security, and it's going to be used against you, and it's being used against you right now. And if you want to understand how these systems are put in place, then you can read the book and find out. And I should say, another term that's being thrown around a lot, along with fake news, is this idea of a deep state, which I have never used and I would not use, because I don't know what people mean by it. But it seems to be this kind of blank slate that anybody can project anything they want onto it. I think what people mean when they talk about a deep state are these systems like Phoenix that have been put in place, which are so complex that unless you study them like you were going to study anthropology for 4 years at Harvard or the petrochemical industry, you can barely grasp. And so people think that it's somehow secret and hidden from them. But if a person has the time and can study them, then you can understand how these systems work, and you can see how they relate to Congress, to the Department of Justice, the legal system. You can see how they relate to the media. You can see how they relate to foreign operations. And suddenly all these things become clear, and all the things that have been hidden from you appear before you, And it's not, you realize that all the facts have been there all along. If you'd only had time to study it and look into it, and you realize, well, there really is no deep state. There's just a lot of things that are beyond what you know. And that if you had the time to study them, you could figure it out. You know, I mean, just like executives at Fox News know what the news is going to be 2-3 weeks from now. They know it's brewing, you know, and then they're not surprised on it like you are when you think it's news and it's a rabbit pulled out of a hat. But the people who run the government are plotting these things 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years, 10 years into the future. And the people in the media are just as aware of what the government has planned, you know, as the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee. So there really isn't a deep state. There really isn't fake news. There's just things you don't know. And don't mythify them and don't make them seem like somehow it's the Wizard of Oz behind, you know, pulling magic tricks, you know. It's all there. You can know it all. It's all very human. It's all very understandable. You just got to devote the time to it and don't get into the mindset of thinking of these people as like somehow they're extra special or something. They've just put a lot of systems in place which are used to control you.
In other words, then, would you say that the deep state is the state? And the issue is basically that citizens don't understand what our country is.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can make it into a magic show if you know, but that just suits the ruling elite, you know, as if somehow this is all, you know, beyond you, or you can't understand it, or you can't see it. I mean, but that's just not true. I mean, I was a working class kid who, you know, dropped out of college and smoked a lot of pot for a couple of years and liked to drink. And was kind of adventurous. And William Colby liked me, and he introduced me to a lot of CIA officers, and they told me what was going on. And it demythified the whole thing for me. And I'm not saying, well, if I did it, anybody could do it. My situation was unusual. But I can't, having been there and come back, I can tell you there is no mystery to it. The only thing is that the media and your government prevent you from knowing about it. And if you want to know about it, you can. You just got to make them tell you what's going on. And you can do that. You can change laws. But obviously, you got to want to do it bad enough.
Is the CIA being restructured? And if that's the case, what model is the intelligence agency using to reorganize itself?
Well, that's a good question, because it was reorganized in 2015 under Brennan. John Brennan, who was the director of Central Intelligence and was a career CIA officer. And again, and to a large extent, it was modeled on, this reorganization was modeled on the Phoenix program. The Phoenix program was, it's complex, but one of the foundation stones for it were, there was a Phoenix directorate. When they created the Phoenix program in Saigon in 1967, in the summer of 1967, they set up a Phoenix directorate in Saigon, which was really like the command center. There was also a Phoenix committee above this directorate, and that Phoenix committee consisted of the CIA station chief, and a deputy ambassador who ran civil operations and revolutionary development, and a couple of generals, general who ran counterintelligence, general who ran intelligence. And those five guys were like a executive committee that oversaw this directorate. And the directorate had sub-offices in every region, province, and district in South Vietnam. They set them up over about a year. The provinces were like states in the United States, and the districts were like counties. 44 provinces, every one of them had a Phoenix Intelligence Operations and Coordinating Center. And in all the districts, there was a District Intelligence Operations and Coordinating Center. And down at the district, they ran informant nets and agent nets into the villages and hamlets, and they tried to identify anybody who was against the government, anybody who was aiding the communists, anybody that could be easily blackmailed, you know, the people in the DIOCs, like they all had different prejudices and business interests, and the whole thing was just so corrupt that they used it as a way of just terrifying the population of South Vietnam into supporting the government. And they would send their reports from the district to the province, and the province would send them to the regions, and the regions would send it to the Phoenix Directorate, where it was all incorporated into computer systems, where everybody in South Vietnam had a profile and were rated on a scale of 1 to 5, whether they were actually a dangerous person or somebody who, you know, at the other end of 5 wasn't too dangerous and should just be extorted and blackmailed and ripped off and terrorized. And, you know, but if you were number 1, then you got killed and put in jail for the rest of your life and tortured. And that was the Phoenix system. Well, before I get to how the CIA was restructured, that's the system that's the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security.
That's the voice of Douglas Valentine. Today's show, The Deep State as Fake News. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. You're listening to Guns and Butter. Today is a fundraiser for KPFA, and I'm, of course, very happy to be able to support incredible author Douglas Valentine with his book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. It's a big book, 446 pages to be exact. It's an incredible anthology of standalone chapters. One of the great things about this book is you don't have to start at page 1 and read through 446 pages. You can pick it up anywhere in any chapter because they're all standalone and they're all on different various subjects having to do with the CIA as organized crime. That's The CIA as Organized Crime, an incredible book that I'm very happy to offer today for your financial support to KPFA, a $140 donation, and the station can send you this really incredible book that Doug Valentine worked on for many, many years. Please support KPFA today, support Doug Valentine, and also support the courageous Clarity Press that has published the CIA as Organized Crime, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, your $140 tax-deductible donation will go to support KPFA, and we would be delighted to provide you with this really incredible book. And it also supports this courageous publisher, Clarity Press. Besides publishing Doug Valentine, they publish Francis Boyle. They publish David Ray Griffin. They publish Stephen Lendman, Graham McQueen, Cynthia McKinney, James Petras, Paul Craig Roberts. These are just a few of the many incredibly outspoken and courageous authors that the Clarity Press publishes. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. A $140 donation today to Free Speech Radio KPFA, and we would be delighted to provide you with this incredible, incredible book. I can't recommend it highly enough. Of course, in these interviews with Douglas Valentine, we're only really able to scratch the surface of what's in this book, but I hope that we're going to be able to cover enough of it so that you realize how incredible this book really is. He talks about how Phoenix was developed as a model, and it's used now as a model for homeland security, that the systems are in place. As you heard him say, the systems are organized and managed for political repression. He talks about the idea of a deep state. He doesn't agree with the idea of a deep state. As you heard him talk about it, the deep state is the state. This is a one big thing. And it is a unique book, an incredibly unique book. Doug Valentine went on to talk about how it isn't a deep state, that the deep state, in his opinion, is fake news, that all it is a lot of things that you don't know. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. If you do go online to pledge, I think you have to scroll down to books, and there you will find the CIA as organized crime. A $25 donation makes you a member of KPFA for 1 year. Donations in any amount are gratefully received. As I've said many times on the show, and a lot of people have pointed out, if everyone who listened to KPFA donated $25, we wouldn't even have to have fundraisers. So it's always a handful of you out there that are so incredibly generous. You support Guns and Butter, support Doug Valentine, KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. This book has a lot in it, and I can give you a few of the chapters. You know, a lot of these chapters are actually developed out of interviews that Doug Valentine has done over the years. There's a couple of introductions. Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 are actually introductions, how William Colby gave me the keys to the CIA kingdom. And then Chapter 2, one thing leads to another, my rare access investigating the war on drugs. There's an awful lot of information in this book on the war on drugs. He really deconstructs it, how the CIA actually is part of the DEA now. Part one, the CIA's Phoenix Program in Vietnam, a template for systematic domination. And then, of course, under part one, there are many chapters. Part two, how the CIA co-opted and manages the war on drugs. Part three, the Phoenix Foundation of Homeland Security. Part four, manufacturing complicity, shaping the American worldview. And we're going to hear a little bit more today about Doug Valentine's take on the media and the, what would you say it? Actually, the melding of the media with the CIA. The book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World, $140 tax-deductible donation today on Guns and Butter to support KPFA, to support the Pacifica Network, non-commercial, listener-supported radio. We come to you a good four times a year for your support, and that way we don't have to take any corporate or commercial funding. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. I'd like to thank those of you who pledged on Guns and Butter last Wednesday, and also thank you so much to everyone who is listening to my voice right now who hasn't yet pledged their financial support to KPFA. Now is a good time to do it, right now. 1-800-439-5732. 732. Well, let's see. What is the book jacket? This is what the book jacket says. The book sheds light on the elaborate system of surveillance, control, entrapment, imprisonment, torture, and assassination the CIA evolved against the civilian population of South Vietnam, and how these practices remain operational today in Afghanistan, El Salvador, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and elsewhere. It discusses how the CIA infiltrated federal drug law enforcement agencies and commandeered their executive management, intelligence, and foreign operations staffs in order to ensure that the flow of drugs continues unimpeded to traffickers and foreign officials in its employ. Valentine shows how these terrorism and drug law enforcement practices enable the CIA to impact social and political movements worldwide, deceiving and propagandizing the American public into lauding its actions, while their true nature is protected by a government-enforced shield of official secrecy and plausible deniability. Not least, Valentine tracks the steady infiltration of CIA praxis against the last target of the American empire, the increasingly restive American people. The CIA as organized crime, how illegal operations corrupt America and the world, by Douglas Valentine. Our thank you gift today to each of you who can pledge at the $140 level to KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. You're listening to Guns and Butter. Of course, we're asking you for your support for KPFA as we do each fun drive. Well, what do you think, Erica? Can we go on and listen to a little bit more of Doug Valentine?
And finally, the last thing to say about this is the CIA does, and I explain this in depth in the book, it doesn't work for the average American. Any more than, you know, I mean, all the working class people that I know voted for Trump because they think he's going to help the little guy. Well, I can tell you right now, when the CIA executive officers are sitting around deciding what to do, they're not thinking about helping the little guy. They're thinking about helping the corporations that run this country. And they're like the Rex Tillerson Exxon people. That's the level that the CIA works at. And it considers, the CIA considers America not to be 300 million little guys, but the 50,000 people who run this country, who own the corporations, the people in Congress, the generals and who sit on the boards of these corporations. The CIA serves those people. It's a capitalist venture designed to enrich the richest people in this country, the people who have enacted the laws that have created the Department of Homeland Security, not to help the little guy, but to preserve their wealth and to increase the police repression in this country. That's the thing you have to understand about the CIA and the systems that have been organized in this country. They're not, the systems that have been put in this country aren't there to help you, the little guy. They're to help the 1% of the 1% that decide everything that's going to happen, that decide foreign policy, that decide domestic policy. And every once in a while, you have to put up with people voting every 4 years. You know, and some bomb thrower like Trump can get elected, and then you have to deal with it. But they will deal with Trump, and Trump will be assimilated because Trump is a billionaire capitalist who's been part of this ruling elite all his life. And he may have some unorthodox ideas about Russia, but he will be assimilated. And the military and the CIA and the State Department and within a month or two are all going to be perfectly happy with him. And Brian in the House and Mitch McConnell in the Senate will have brought him under control. They'll use him as a stalking horse to get away with his enacting as much repressive Republican legislation as they can, you know, and within the limits of their possibility. But if you want to know how the CIA functions as a tool of the rich ruling capitalist elite, then you can read my book. I don't know anything about Russia and JFK. I wish I did have some insights into that. A bunch of CIA officers I talked to thought that people in the military and the CIA may well and the corporate bosses may well have assassinated Kennedy. I talked to CIA guys and guys in the DEA who thought that too. But that's because they were the people that could pull that off. Work at a level, the same level of the owner as Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox News Corporation, the same level as the people who own the New York Times, the same level as as Rex Tillerson that owned ExxonMobil, the same level as the people that own the arms industry in this country, Hewlett Packard, the big arms industries, and all the generals on there, big lieutenant generals that on their payroll that sit on the boards. 50,000 people, 100,000 people that rule this country. That's where the CIA works. And the CIA, if you talk about it as the CIA wanted to do something, it couldn't do something really all that independently without having some consensus about all these people that are all, you know, at that super capitalist predator Bill Gates level. That's where, and if people wanted to do a public service, make a flow chart, an organizational chart of that group. You know, then you could start seeing where power really flows in this country and see how it's connected to these people are connected to the CIA and the FBI and the military. Then you would start getting a really good understanding of how this country is run and who owns it and how they're using the CIA. But the CIA is not an entity like the Bermuda Triangle that people step into and all of a sudden they vanish. You know, it's got systems and the systems are in controlled by political people like Donald Trump who work within this rich capitalist elite affecting its objectives. And they convince an awful lot of millions of Americans that somehow they've got the little guy's interests at heart. And that's another big lie.
You know, Doug, I was about to ask you whose agenda or what agenda is it that the CIA is carrying out? And it seems like it would be, particularly with the remarks you've just made, it would be the agenda of say, Wall Street, let's say, the big bank.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Goldman Sachs. If you want to know who the CIA works for, look at Goldman Sachs. You know, I mean, these are the people when Franklin Roosevelt created the OSS, which, you know, evolved into the CIA. He didn't go around picking little guys, normal people. You know, these are not the people considered people who have a stake in the United States. You know, they're worker bees who's, you know, if you have to give them Social Security, it's like, my God, you know, some. I can't give these people Social Security. I mean, they should be working 50, 60, 70 hours a week for low wages. I mean, that's what Goldman Sachs thinks, you know, and those are the people that determine currency rates. And if they think that there's somehow the currency rate between India and China is devaluing some industry that Goldman Sachs wants to control, well, activate the CIA. Go in there, subvert India, you know, have them create some financial crisis, and now all of a sudden the exchange rate is right, and Goldman Sachs is happy, and some American corporations can move in. Or, you know, it's hard to separate American corporations because it's all now multinational corporations, you know. I mean, people think that, you know, trade agreements are somehow anti-American. Well, look at the corporations. You know, I mean, or where do you think Toyota manufactures its cars? You know, I mean, we're being deluded. And right now, this hurricane, tornado of supposed fake news and all this talk of the deep state, which means meaningless, absolutely innocuous, meaningless term. All these terms are floating around and people are unraveling themselves trying to figure it out. I mean, they're trying to figure out what fake news is. Well, why don't you try to figure out what's real and what's happening? You know, and study things factually. The books are there, folks. You know, you can go read them. It really, all the facts are there. It's just very frustrating to me. And of course, like everybody, I get swept up in it. But, as confused as everybody else about what's real and what isn't real these days. But if you take a deep breath and you relax, you can figure it out. The facts are there. A fact. Donald Trump wants to destroy the Environmental Protection Agency. Okay, this is what he's going to do. He is not doing this to help the little guy. He may say he's doing it to help the little guy, but he's doing it to help corporations. You know, I mean, Obama sort of dithered around Standing Rock. It took Trump 4 days to get rid of those people. You know, this is what's going to be happening around the country. Trump is out to help the rich, political elite, and steal everything from you. That's the thing that you need to know. And that's the thing that you need to start organizing and working against, or else by the time all this fake news, deep state stuff blows over, you're going to be in prison and your environment's going to be gone.
You write that the media organizes itself the way the CIA does, that the CIA has case officers running around the world engaged in murder and mayhem, and the media has reporters covering them. What are the similarities between the organization of the media and the organization of the CIA?
Yeah, okay. And that gets it to absolutely, well, what is America? Well, you know, America started out as a slave state, but it was always a capitalist state. The people that created our country were large landowners. You know, and they didn't like paying taxes to the British, so they created a government that initially excluded women, people who didn't own property, men who didn't own property, and blacks, of course, who the Constitution rated as 3/5 of human being. And they stole, they killed all the indigenous people on the continent over the course of, you know, 300 years or whatever it was, and stole everything they had. That is the ethic. These are the ethics that define the United States of America. And that since the country was created, as it's sort of liberalized, systems have been put in place to maintain the status and prerogatives of the ruling class, the same kind of ruling class that created this country. And as it expands, laws, tax laws, property laws, all kind of, you know, a whole, starting in the beginning of the 20th century, you know, departments of justice, customs, all these different systems are put in place. And the systems are all designed to protect the interests of this rich ruling class. And while we don't have slavery anymore, it took until the 1960s to get rid of the Jim Crow laws and segregation. And of course, we're still a segregated country. You know, I mean, that still exists. And black people are still pitted against poor white people, just like they were when the country was created. And all these systems are in place, but now they're more highly bureaucratized. Technocrats run them. They're in place and they're so deep, it seems like you can't see them, although you can feel them and you can see the results of them all the time. And one of the systems that's evolved in the 250 years that we've been around is the system of information, of how we view our country, what we know about it. And the same way that the rich ruling elite has controlled and structured all these other systems. And believe me, it wasn't the little guy that put these systems in place. It was the rich political elite that puts all these systems in place. They have put in systems of media management. Okay. And in this sense, the media serves basically the same function as the CIA, which is a system, or the military, which is a system, or the education system, which of course is part of the media. And as you know, if you went to school, you grew up being told that America was the greatest country on the earth, and you probably weren't told about slavery, and you probably weren't told about a lot of things that anything that diminished America's stature in your little adolescent mind. And you grew up believing all these myths about America as the land of opportunity and the country that's going to bring democracy to the world. And in the meantime, it's got this hidden CIA and it's waging war, and it's got the biggest military in the world, a military that's bigger than all the other militaries of the world combined. And yet you still think it's a victim, and you got to worry about ISIS and Muslims and Mexican immigrants. Well, why is this? Because a system of media management has been put in place and has evolved over 250 years as well. And that system of media management, which extends into education, and everything else that you learn at Hollywood and TV especially, which is the ultimate, because as the little guy, your only function is to buy commodities that the capitalists produce at outrageous rates and buy commodities that you don't need, have no value to your, have no intrinsic value to your life, but simply pollute the environment and make your life worse. But TV ads make you think that all this stuff is fine. And when you see people on TV, you say, God, I want to be like him. I want to be like Meryl Streep, or I want to be like Paul Newman. You know, I mean, and I could live that life, you know. And these systems, which not just TV and the movies and education system, but the daily news that you get, all these things are controlled. They're a system that are controlled the same way that the CIA is controlled. And at the very highest levels of the media, they are the CIA. And that's why they don't tell you about the CIA, because that's their part in the overall spectacle, is not to tell you about these things so you continue to believe all these myths about America, and not just myths about America, but most importantly, myths about yourself that you've learned through your education, through what you see on TV, and that the, as soon as Nike comes out with a new pair of sneakers, boom, off you go and you buy it. And maybe you're a Pepsi guy, or maybe you're a Coke guy, you know, but you like Pepsi and you like Coke because, like Trump, they say they want good relations with Russia. You know, and so you know, it's all this systems that have been in place are elaborate, and they've evolved over 200 years, but they all have the same purpose. And that's why I say in the book, at the highest levels, the CIA is the same as the media. And the way you rise from, you know, a lowly entry-level person in the CIA to head the CIA is the same way you rise up through, you know, the New York Times, for example. You know, you start out as a cub reporter, and if you write articles that show that you have an aptitude for disclosing, for covering up the things that Americans shouldn't know, and telling them the things that they should know, the way they should know it, well, then maybe you'll become a more important reporter. You know, and then if you really, they might let you actually have contact with a CIA officer, you know, and up you go until you, through all these ideological, you know, tests that are given to you, until, you know, someday you're in executive management and you're actually talking to guys in the CIA executive management, and they're telling you, well, you know, in about 2 years, we're going to be overthrowing the government of the Philippines, you know, which we really don't like right now because they've been bad to Westinghouse. And Westinghouse wants to build a nuclear reactor in one of their provinces. And there's a bunch of congressmen there. And we're getting rid of them, by the way. But when we do, you know, there's going to be room for you guys there, and you're going to get a news bureau and stuff like that. I mean, that's what goes on at these highest levels. And these people at the highest level have no blinders over their eyes. They have no illusions. They're all in it together as a mafia. And again, it's hard to explain these things in 20 minutes or 40 minutes or an hour. And even this book, The CIA's Organized Crime, how its operations corrupt everything. And that's corruption in the sense of corrupting you so that you don't know who you are. You're not even in touch with your humanity or the humanity of, you know, say if you're, you know, you might have feelings about blacks, or you might have, if you're black, you might have feelings about Mexicans. I mean, how the information you receive is through the media is making you feel these things. If you want to understand those kind of things, read my book. You know, some of these other things that you talk about, I don't know anything about, but very realistically, I can, you know, the book outlines how that works, how that system's work. And, you know, it has to do with capitalism and the ideology that capitalism advances, which is, you know, that you know, 1% of the 1% of the 1% are the big dogs, and they deserve everything because they take it.
That's the voice of Douglas Valentine. Today's show, The Deep State as Fake News. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. You're listening to Guns and Butter today. We are in a fund drive for our station KPFA, part of the Pacifica Network. It looks like I've got about 10 or 11 minutes to get a few, hopefully more than a few of you, on the phone to give us a call with your financial support for KPFA. Of course, today, Doug Valentine and I are talking about his new book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. It's a pretty big book, 446 pages. It's divided into many chapters on many different subjects, and it's a unique book in that you can pick it up anywhere and read any chapter you want in any order because they're all standalone. It's a terrific book. I can't recommend it highly enough. I'd love to get some support for the work of Doug Valentine, who, of course, has been pretty much blackballed by the mainstream media. He's gotten bad reviews and no reviews. Also, I'd like to get some support for his courageous publisher, Clarity Press, at claritypress.com. In addition to publishing Doug Valentine, they publish, let's see, who are some of these authors that they publish? Oops, I'm losing it here now. I just had it up on the screen. Paul Craig Roberts, Jack Rasmus, Scott Ritter, James Petras, Cynthia McKinney, Graham McQueen, Stephen Lenman, David Ray Griffin, Francis Boyle. Many of these people you've heard on Guns and Butter. This is the kind of publisher that Clarity Press is. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. A $140 donation to KPFA right now. And our thank you gift to you today is this incredible new book by Doug Valentine, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. 1-800-439-5732. You can pledge online securely at kpfa.org. You have to scroll around a bit and click on books, but you'll find it there. The CIA as Organized Crime, $140 tax-deductible donation right now to Free Speech Radio KPFA. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Today's show, The Deep State as Fake News. Doug Valentine doesn't like the phrase, the deep state. According to him, the state is the state. It's just a question of you're not knowing pretty much the character of the state. 1-800-439-5732. I'd like to let you know, it's a big book. There's a lot in here. I want to let you know a little bit of the content so you know what you were getting when you pledged today. The Vietnam War's Silver Lining, A Bureaucratic Model for Population Control Emerges. The Systematic Gathering of Intelligence. What We Really Learned from Vietnam, A War Crimes Model for Afghanistan and Elsewhere. The Afghan Dirty War Escalates. Vietnam Replay on Afghan Defectors. Disrupting the Accommodation, CIA Killers Spell Victory in Afghanistan and Defeat in America. So you can see there's a lot on Afghanistan in this book. The CIA in Ukraine. War Crimes as Policy. New Games, Same Aims. CIA Organizational Changes. And that is just the titles in part one. The CIA as Organized Crime. An incredible book, our gift to you today for a $140 tax-deductible donation to KPFA. If you haven't called yet, if you haven't pledged to KPFA this year, please call us now, 1-800-439-5732. As always, a $25 donation makes you a member of KPFA for a year. If everyone hearing my voice called in and either pledged $25 or $140 for the book, we'd be well on our way to keeping KPFA on the air. 1-800-439-5732. Of course, today's show is called The Deep State as Fake News with Doug Valentine, and we are offering him his brand new book, The CIA as Organized Crime. Well, let's see what's in part two. Creating a Crime, How the CIA Commandeered the Drug Enforcement Administration. Beyond Dirty Wars, the CIA-DEA Connection and Modern-Day Terror in Latin America. Project Gunrunner. Then in part three, The Spook Who Became a Congressman, Why CIA Officers Cannot Be Allowed to Hold Public Office. Major General Bruce Lawler, from CIA officer to Vietnam to Homeland Security honcho. Homeland Security, the Phoenix Comes Home to Roost. That's some of the titles in part three in the CIA as Organized Crime. Incredible new book by Doug Valentine. Our gift to you today for $140. I'd love to get some more of you on the phone. Thank you so much to all of you who have called to support Guns and Butter, to support Doug Valentine, to support his courageous publisher, Clarity. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.com. .org. Let's see what's in part four. Fragging Bob Kerry, the CIA and the Need for a War Crimes Tribunal. Top Secret America Shadow Reward System. How the Government Tries to Mess with Your Mind. Disguising Obama's Dirty War. Parallels of Conquest, Past and Present. Propaganda as Terrorism, The War on Terror as the Greatest Covert Op Ever. That's the CIA as Organized Crime, our gift to you today, an incredible book, 446 pages for a donation of $140, published by Clarity Press. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. You're listening to Guns and Butter. Guns and Butter is produced on a weekly basis by myself, by Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. 1-800-439-5732. Please support the work that we do here on Guns and Butter. Support the station that gives us our airtime, KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. From a review by Edward Curtin, had this to say in his latest book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Valentine explains it thus, but the left's leadership is part of the CIA's old boy network, and like all American intellectuals, they look to the Times for direction and validation. So the word went out to ignore the book, not just because it revealed CIA secrets, but because it identified the media, and the Times in particular, as the reason why the public can't see the CIA clearly for what it is, a criminal conspiracy on behalf of wealthy capitalists. 1-800-439-5732, $140, and the station will send you the CIA as Organized Crime, by Douglas Valentine, published by Clarity Press. Well, Ed Curtin has a lot to say. It's a very long review of Doug's incredible book. Using what the CIA officer Frank Wisner called the agency's, quote, mighty Wurlitzer, its deep penetration of the news and cultural apparatus, it played the American people to a tune of CIA heroes defending the homeland from mad Muslim terrorists and evil drug dealers besieging the U.S. citadel through deception and direct attack. Movies, television shows, cognitive infiltration of the mainstream media across platforms repeated the message over and over again.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Okay, January 28 was not the day the music died. But something wonderful was alive back when Paul Kantner and Signe Anderson were flourishing, and that something is long dead. Or is it? I'll explore, with some help from commentator Glenn Ford, W.H. Auden, and the Jefferson Airplane. I hope you'll stay tuned. I am usually unmoved when a famous actor or musician dies. I'm not necessarily proud of this. It might be a certain moral numbness on my part, but that's the way I am. For me, February 3, 1959, was not the day the music died. I was alive on that day, and acquainted with some of Buddy Holly's music. But I didn't even discover he was dead until many years later, to say nothing of the big bopper, whoever he was. Okay, I was only 8 and a half at the time they died. And no, I haven't forgotten Ritchie Valens. But even later, the deaths of Jimi Hendrix, of Janis Joplin, even of John Lennon, failed to make much of an impression on me. Then, a couple of weeks ago, I came across an obituary of a fairly obscure musician, one Signe Tolley Anderson. I learned from it that, in fact, she and Paul Kantner both had died on the same day, January 28, 2016. Both had been members of the famed San Francisco psychedelic rock band Jefferson Airplane. Signe Anderson was the group's first female vocalist. She left the group after their first album and was replaced by Grace Slick. Paul Kantner was a singer and the group's rhythm guitarist. Somehow the deaths on the same day of both Signe Anderson and Paul Kantner struck a nerve, moved me, saddened me, reminded me of something important we have lost. For me, Jefferson Airplane created the quintessential music of the late 1960s, the period I came of age, and changed in other ways too. My college years, the years I realized that my own government was prosecuting an immoral and evil war abroad, accompanied by stunning repression at home. With the military draft in full force, I had to decide what I would and would not do, and what consequences I was prepared to endure. I and several million other young people. Pretty heady stuff for a 19-year-old from a small town in Pennsylvania. And yet we, who ended up opposing the system, never felt hopeless or alone. There were large numbers of people opting out of the mainstream capitalistic war machine and creating alternatives before our very eyes, all around. Many, many alternative communities united by our refusal to accept the evil machine. At least, most of us united in celebrating the virtues of peace, love, sexual liberation, and nonviolence. We saw ourselves not as social dropouts, but as the counterculture. Most of us didn't enlist in the counterculture completely. I myself stayed pretty conventional in many respects. But we identified with and participated in the movement, the counterculture. Make love, not war, the slogan went, and we did. We burned our draft cards and the occasional draft board's office files. What I miss especially from those days is the sense of optimism and of community, of the power of the grassroots, the power of the people. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young sang, "We can change the world, rearrange the world," and we felt it was true. That's what I miss especially, the feeling that our name is Legion, we peace and love types, for we are many, the feeling that we really could change the world. And we were partially right. We could and did. To an extent. For a while. Then it pretty much changed back. Eventually, the establishment and the war machine and the capitalism machine and the plutocracy regained the upper hand. And that was the end of the counterculture and Hate Ashbury and the Summer of Love and the chant, "Hell no, we won't go." Maybe all old men feel this nostalgia for their youthful days. I don't know. But I really do miss the feeling that the people did have some power to shape events. The feeling of endless possibilities. And I deeply miss the feeling that I am part of an alternative community. That I am not alone. There are millions like me. We recognize one another as brothers and sisters. Water brothers, we help one another. The Jefferson Airplane captured the sense of optimism and love and power and possibilities of the alternative community. The deaths of Signe Anderson and Paul Kantner hit me hard because the Jefferson Airplane symbolized and fostered the feelings of hope and power to the people and community. The feelings that an alternative world was not only possible, it was being built all around us. A better world of love and peace and justice. A new continent of earth and fire. We could see it happening locally. And the people in this alternative world looked beautiful and seemed authentic. And the sex was great. And the popular music struck a chord deep in the soul. And for me, the music of Jefferson Airplane struck the chord the most deeply. They did then, and they still do today. Here are some passages from the Airplane that beautifully celebrate the beauty of the counterculture and the power of the counterculture to change the world for the better. The late Signe Anderson is not involved in this selection. The late Paul Kantner is. I thank them both. But I think what should make us grieve is not the loss of two good musicians, but the loss of community and optimism and alternatives and hope. The stuff that the Jefferson Airplane's music embodies and celebrates. As some lyrics go, "We can be together, my friend, a new continent of earth and fire. Tear down the walls, tear down the walls, won't you try?" Jefferson Airplane. We commemorate the deaths of members Paul Kantner and Signe Tolle Anderson, each at the age of 74, each of cancer, each died on January 28, 2016. We heard parts of the Airplane's songs We Can Be Together and Volunteers. My thoughts about this seminal counterculture rock band triggered a few other thoughts. Several weeks ago, I saw Stanley Nelson's new documentary film, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. The Black Panthers and the Jefferson Airplane were from about the same period. The Panthers were an anti-establishment, grassroots, black power group, and remarkably effective in gaining members and followers. Enough to scare the bejesus out of J. Edgar Hoover and his clones in urban police departments coast to coast, notably Chicago. With the help of the FBI, Chicago's cops attacked and killed the charismatic and effective Panther leader, Fred Hampton, as he slept in his own bed. This assassination came as no great surprise to the Panthers, or to the white members of the counterculture. Many of them had recently had their heads bashed by the Chicago cops while peacefully protesting outside the site of the 1968 Democratic Convention. The lines I quoted a few minutes ago from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young were referring to this incident in Chicago. And we shall hear more about the Chicago police today, in a moment, from Glenn Ford. Some things never seem to change. Watching the Black Panthers movie, I was struck again by how beautiful the counterculture types looked. The Panthers, male and female, with their youth and their bearing that proclaimed strength and self-confidence and personal power. And those beautiful afros, as the natural hairstyle was called. A popular slogan of the time was, "Black is beautiful." And it was. The Jefferson Airplane and the counterculture it represented also made me think of Occupy Wall Street. October 2011 is when this movement began. It was small, perhaps, but quite reminiscent of the late 1960s. It came 43 years after 1968. But 2011 was the first time that large numbers of American people were acting like we did back when Jefferson Airplane was singing We Can Be Together. My heart leapt up when I beheld this rainbow in the sky. And you know it takes a lot to get me quoting Wordsworth. In recent days, we've also seen grassroots rebellion, a lot of it in a lot of places, by black people. Outraged at the callous indifference and the violence the establishment is inflicting upon them. Police killings of black people especially, and not that only. A new wrinkle is that today many more black people are holding government office than they did back in the late 1960s, including the highest elected government office. However, that representation has made precious little difference to the average black citizen, or to anyone else. Commentator Glenn Ford has talked for years of how very many black officeholders have sold out their constituents and aligned themselves with the establishment. Ford refers to them as the black misleadership class. But sometimes the power of the people and the outrage of the people gets strong enough that even their elected misleaders are forced to do the right thing, to an extent. Here is Glenn Ford with a brief commentary. It is titled, Youth Leads the Struggle in Chicago.
Chicago Sun-Times columnist Lynn Sweet said she hadn't seen Mayor Rahm Emanuel so shaken in 20 years as when he was forced to fire his police superintendent, Gary McCarthy, this week. It seemed as if the protective shield of black misleadership class collaboration that has for the last 30 years insulated white mayors from the wrath of Chicago's outraged black rank and file had suddenly been stripped away. Black ministers joined militant youth in marching down the city's Magic Mile Michigan Avenue shopping district, demanding that heads roll for hiding video evidence in the death of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, shot 16 times by Officer Jason Van Dyke. For 400 days, Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez refused to indict the cop or release the police dashboard video of the shooting or to explain why another critical video had apparently been destroyed. Alvarez finally bowed to pressure and a court order, indicting the cop for first-degree murder and releasing the death video. But the community's rage could not be contained. The Black Caucus of Chicago's Board of Aldermen demanded that Police Superintendent McCarthy resign. So did Reverend Jesse Jackson and even Bobby Rush, the sellout black congressman who's been a dependable servant of the Emanuel administration. The strength of the movement in Chicago can be measured by the fact that so many elements of the black collaborationist political class have been forced to take a stance in opposition to Mayor Emanuel and the white corporate forces that he represents, and ultimately to compel the mayor to fire his favorite cop. However, if left to their own devices, if allowed to seize control of what is essentially a black youth political rebellion, the black misleaders will smother the movement in proceduralisms and long drawn-out studies and compliant advisory boards and all manner of other diversions, as they have always done. That's their job as the black junior partners in the permanent white corporate state. The young people that are the soldiers of this struggle understand that movements are defined by their demands. In a joint statement by the Black Youth Project 100, We Charge Genocide, Asada's Daughters, the Let Us Breathe Collective, and a Black Lives Matter chapter, they declared that indicting cops does not change the policies that promote the violence and trauma inherent in the Chicago Police Department. They want Rahm Emanuel's resignation, too. The Black Youth Project also demands defunding of the Chicago Police and investment of those dollars in the black community. They call for reparations for slavery, Jim Crow, and mass black incarceration, an end to all profit in the criminal justice system, a guaranteed income for all, a federal jobs program, and freedom from discrimination for all workers, and an end to displacement of black people through gentrification. These are demands for social transformation, demands that will put the young activists on a collision course with the black misleadership class, who are the first line of defense for the white ruling class, and who will soon close ranks in Chicago and elsewhere to try to stop this movement. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
In Chicago, bad cops serving a corrupt municipal government, which in turn serves the corrupt ruling elite. As it is today, so it was in my day, and so it was in Chicago long before that, too. Hey, I never said that 1968 was paradise, just that there was something wonderful in the air, and it wasn't just tetrahydrocannabinol either. The scent of freedom was in the air, and possibility, and alternatives, and a new world with more love and less violence and no more war. There was a big war going on at the time in Vietnam, but we had hopes of bringing it to an end, starting with ending our own individual complicity right now. And in fact, the people eventually did stop that war. Of course, in 1968, as now, many American people had no sympathy for the counterculture. Many people were trained to be passive and obedient, trained to obey all authority, to blindly follow custom, to not make waves, to keep their noses clean, to conform in all ways. All the corporate-controlled media urged them to stay the course, and so did all the established mainstream churches, to say nothing of the Boy Scouts. I, too, was brought up to be like that. I changed a lot when I went off to college. Others didn't. W. H. Auden has a nice poem satirizing the unthinking, obedient conformists that the government and the corporate elite want the citizens to become. I discovered the poem about the same time I discovered the Jefferson Airplane, 1968 or 69. It's called The Unknown Citizen. Auden wrote it in 1939, just before World War II. But it wasn't Hitler that Auden was trying to warn us about. In this poem, he imagines a monument that the establishment erects, celebrating the ideal, conformist, unthinking, obedient dolt that the establishment wants the average citizen to be. The opposite of the 1960s counterculture. The poem's words are the supposed inscription on this grand monument, honoring the ideal, patriotic, obedient non-entity. No draft card burner, he. It's good satire, down to the bad meter and rhymes. Just what you'd expect from a government bureaucrat. Let me read it. The Unknown Citizen. To JS/07/M/378, this marble monument is erected by the state. He was found by the Bureau of Statistics to be one against whom there was no official complaint, and all the reports on his conduct agree that, in the modern sense of an old-fashioned word, he was a saint, for in everything he did, he served the greater community. Except for the war, till the day he retired, he worked in a factory and never got fired, but satisfied his employers, Fudge Motors, Inc. Yet he wasn't a scab or odd in his views, for his union reports that he paid his dues. Our report on his union shows it was sound. And our social psychology workers found that he was popular with his mates and liked to drink. The press are convinced that he bought a paper every day, and that his reactions to advertisements were normal in every way. Policies taken out in his name prove that he was fully insured, and his health card shows that he was once in the hospital but left it cured. Both producers' research and high-grade living declare he was fully sensible to the advantages of the installment plan, and had everything necessary to the modern man, a phonograph, a radio, a car, and a Frigidaire. Our researchers into public opinion are content that he held the proper opinions for the time of year. When there was peace, he was for peace. When there was war, he went. He was married and added 5 children to the population, which our eugenist says was the right number for a parent of his generation, and our teachers report that he never interfered with their education. Was he free? Was he happy? The question is absurd. Had anything been wrong, we should certainly have heard. With W. H. Auden's The Unknown Citizen, we end our eulogy for a better time. A period when the 99% was not so beaten down, depressed, and oppressed as we seem today. Or maybe things aren't quite so bad as all that. Maybe Occupy Wall Street was more than just a flash in the pan. As Glenn Ford notes, the black citizens are getting mighty fed up and taking to the streets, demanding change, and people of other colors are joining them, too. Maybe the late 1960s is not ancient history after all. We can only hope. In any case, rest in peace, Paul Kantner and Signe Tolley Anderson. Thank you for listening to New World Notes, broadcasting from all along the Watchtower here in Darkest Connecticut. On the web, find us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. This is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, war is not healthy for children and other living things. Tune in, turn on, and please come back again next week. Power to the people. Right on. Come on now together. Get it on together. Everybody together. We should be together. We should be together, my friend. We can be together.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No shorthand.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On today's show, we're going to revisit World Trade Center Building 7. There have been two new researchers who have spoken out recently about World Trade Center 7, and we're going to hear from them today. But first, for those of you who may not know, World Trade Center 7 was the third skyscraper to collapse in New York City on 9/11, and it wasn't hit by a plane. It fell at approximately 5:20 on the afternoon of September 11, 2001. It was a 47-story building that came down in 6.5 seconds. There were eyewitnesses who reported hearing a countdown leading up to its collapse. The BBC and CNN reported that it had collapsed before it actually did. The building housed the CIA, the Securities and Exchange Commission, other government agencies, and Mayor Rudy Giuliani's Emergency Management Center. The 9/11 Commission report did not look into World Trade Center 7 and only mentioned it once in a footnote. NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, was tasked with investigating how World Trade Center 7 came down. And their conclusion was that the building collapsed due to fire. Never mind the fact that no steel-framed building has ever collapsed due to fire. The architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth have been continuously challenging NIST on its report of the collapse of World Trade Center 7. NIST won't release much of its work. Barry Jennings worked for the City of New York and went to the Emergency Management Center in World Trade Center 7 on the morning of 9/11, but nobody was there. In his attempt to get out, he reported walking over dead bodies, and he said that all the time he was hearing all types of explosions going off on the floors below him. NIST interviewed Jennings, but has not made their interview public. Although only 53 years old, Barry Jennings reportedly died after several days in a hospital on August 19, 2008. This was just 2 days before NIST had its August 21st press briefing
to announce the draft version of its final report on World Trade Center 7. Professor David Ray Griffin has written at least 10 books about 9/11, and one of them that came out in 2010 is called The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, Why the Final Official Report About 9/11 is Unscientific and False. I highly recommend this book. And this is what Tony Zambodi, a mechanical engineer and former member of the U.S. Navy, has to say about this book. Quote, Professor Griffin's meticulous dissection of NIST's World Trade Center 7 report shows just why its theory of fire-induced progressive collapse is wholly inadequate and essentially fraudulent, and why the actual demise of this huge building could have been brought down only by intentional demolition, which could have been set up and carried out only by domestic forces, unquote. So now let's turn to our two speakers being featured in today's program. The first one is Peter Ketchum, a former NIST employee who has recently spoken out at a December 2016 event in Massachusetts. He's introduced here by Ted Walter of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
The next speaker I'm going to introduce briefly, his name is Peter Ketchum. He is a former employee of NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I'll just give you a very brief background. In August of this year, I, along with a few other authors, two engineers and a physicist, many of them you may know, Stephen Jones, Robert Coral, and Tony Zambodi, published an article in the magazine of the European Physical Society. It's called Europhysics News, and this came out in August. It was called 15 Years Later on the Physics of High-Rise Building Collapses. And this article ended up being viewed now more than 350,000 times, gained a lot of traction, and a lot of controversy was generated from it. As a result of that controversy, the editors of Europhysics News posted a statement kind of explaining their position and inviting any letters to the editor. And so a month or two later, when the next issue of the magazine was published, in the magazine was a letter from Peter Ketchum, this former employee of NIST. And in this letter, as he explains, he did not work on the World Trade Center investigation. And recently this year, he started looking into it and very quickly came to the conclusion that the NIST investigation, I'm just going to put it softly for now and I'll let him fill in the blank, but was not done properly and flew in the face of everything that he knew and his experience of working at NIST. And so I'm going to hand it over to him. And I just want to say that we are very grateful that he has chosen to speak out. And we view this as one step forward. I'm confident that he's going to be a very powerful voice for this pursuit of truth. And so here we go. Peter, thank you very much.
First, I would like to thank Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth for their generosity in bringing me here today. And I would especially like to mention and thank Ted Walter for his intelligence, competence, ability, talent, and commitment. And Ted and I have communicated a fair amount recently, and I could not ask for a better person to work with. Second, I want to say that my thoughts today are my thoughts, and I accept full responsibility for them. As Ted mentioned, I was a member of the NIST technical staff during the period 1997 to 2011. I initially joined the High Performance Systems and Services Division and later became a member of what was, at the time, the Mathematical and Computational Sciences Division of the Information Technology Laboratory. My fellow NIST employees were among the finest and most intelligent people with whom I have ever worked. I did not contribute to the NIST World Trade Center investigation or reports, but I do recognize the names of many who did contribute, and I had some degree of contact or involvement, even if only minimal, with a few of those contributors. A few months ago, based on a conversation with a friend who has no connection to NIST, I began to read some of those NIST World Trade Center reports, including NIST NC Star 1 and NC Star 1A. As I watched several documentaries contradicting the NIST reports and presenting very lucid arguments for controlled demolition, I quickly became furious. First, I was furious with myself. how could I have worked at NIST all those years and not have noticed this before? Second, I was furious with NIST. The NIST I knew was intellectually open, non-defensive, willing to consider competing explanations, and enthusiastic about presenting the details of its research to any interested party. The more I investigated, the more apparent it became that NIST had reached a predetermined conclusion that refused, avoided, and dismissed the evidence. Among the most egregious examples is the explanation for the collapse of World Trade Center 7 as a Rube Goldberg sequence of unlikely events culminating in the almost symmetrical collapse of a steel frame building into its own footprint at freefall acceleration. I believe that NIST is one of the crown jewels of the U.S. federal government and an organization of staggering brilliance. But with respect to the World Trade Center investigation, I think that something went very wrong. I don't know what, but something. I could list all the reasons why the NIST World Trade Center reports don't add up, but others have already done so in extensive detail, and there is little that I could add. What I can do, however, is express some thoughts based on common sense, intuition, and experience drawn from my years at NIST. There are 5 points I'd like to mention. First, in my opinion, NIST is not fooling us anymore. NIST has painted itself into a corner while the walls of evidence and reason close in. One need only read the Europhysics News article and NIST's response to see that. My understanding is that police detectives use the term guilty demeanor to describe the dodging and weaving of a guilty party that desperately claims innocence. One does not need any technical background to see the display of guilty demeanor in the various NIST presentations regarding the World Trade Center investigation and reports. This is especially true of the investigation leaders, who repeatedly evade, dismiss, and obfuscate their way through incomplete and nonsensical explanations. It is not my intention to attack these individuals in making my point, as they may in fact have been under duress. But if the NIST World Trade Center investigation and reports prove false, then they are culpable nonetheless. Second, national security concerns are their own worst enemy. The excuse has worn thin that evidence or information must be withheld due to national security concerns. The irony is that the secretive cloak of national security has itself become a serious threat to our pursuit of happiness with the corruption and dishonesty that it breeds. If NIST truly believes in the veracity of its investigation, then it should openly share all evidence, data, models, computations, and other relevant information unless very specific and compelling reasons are otherwise provided. National security concerns and public safety concerns do not stand in isolation. They participate in a balance with accountability. Third, gingerly approaching the water and dipping in a toe does not constitute a swim in the ocean. In its reports, NIST makes a great show of copious details leading to collapse initiation, and then stops short just when it becomes interesting. The remainder of the explanation is a perfunctory statement that building collapse is inevitable and obvious. It is easy to see through this tactic as an evasion of prickly arguments and an avoidance of inconvenient evidence. Fourth, in response to any challenges, NIST typically provides curt explanations from its public affairs office. I was at NIST for 14 years, and I saw how this game was played. The strategy is to stand as an impervious monolith while also tightly controlling communications. There were many contributors to the NIST World Trade Center investigation. Why not let them openly answer questions in their own voice with the depth of knowledge and level of detail that follows from the nuts and bolts of their research. If the NIST investigation and reports are sincere and genuine, then there is nothing to fear and nothing to hide. Fifth, honesty sooner is better than regret later. Awareness is growing of the disconnect between the NIST World Trade Center reports and logical reasoning. The recent Europhysics news article is a good example. Due to the nature of communication in our current world, that awareness may increase approximately exponentially. Why not NIST blow the whistle on itself now, while there is still time? The wounds of 9/11 have remained unhealed for too long. Those wounds are now festering, rotting, and infected. When the physical body is wounded, the first step is to wash out those wounds with hot soapy water. The process is painful, but the pain does not last, and the worst of it occurs at the start. Truth is the hot and soapy water with which we wash out the wounds of 9/11. With respect to the World Trade Center investigation, the official narrative of 9/11 has begun to unravel, and that unraveling may accelerate. One need only look at recent events, such as the appearance of the Europhysics news article, to see that unraveling in action. As a result, there may be a sequence of painful revelations. We may find that the United States federal government may not be quite the benevolent protector that we thought it was. But the wounds of 9/11 are unlikely to heal amid lies, deception, and misinformation. That is why truth is so important. Finally, I would like to respectfully say and suggest to you that your feelings are not the truth. Your feelings are important and beautiful, but your feelings only tell you how you feel, not what is true. And as I talk to a variety of people about 9/11 and the official narrative, I see in some cases a great deal of difficulty to consider or even accept some of the darker possibilities behind what has happened. And feelings are often a large part of that. So I'm simply saying to consider that although your feelings are important and wonderful and should be respected, that your feelings are not the truth. And finally, I would like to simply summarize by saying, the truth is where our healing lies. Thank you.
And again, you were just listening to Peter Ketchum, a former NIST employee. To see the video of this speech, you can go to YouTube and search for Peter Ketchum. And Ketchum is spelled K-E-T-C-H-A-M. And the next speaker is Professor Leroy Halsey, a structural engineer from the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. He and his top students have been studying the collapse of World Trade Center 7, and this is him speaking about his research at the Justice in Focus conference in New York City in September of 2016. It's a bit technical at the beginning, but that doesn't last long. He's introduced here by architect Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And here they are.
To go into a greater effort to understand what couldn't have happened in this building for its destruction, I'd like to bring up one of the top forensic structural engineers in the country from the University of Alaska, Professor Leroy Halsey, structural engineer, PhD. Professor Halsey?
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here today, and thank you all for giving me the opportunity to be here. So I want to just kind of give you a little bit of an insight of who I am and give you some background before I get into this presentation. I'm actually also a licensed structural engineer. I have been in the business some 40 years. I've worked as an expert at the Avenues of America building, the United Nations building, the Dean Dome in North Carolina and a number of other structures around the country. So what I'm bringing to this presentation is the fact that I've done a lot of work on structural investigations. And so when I was asked to do this, to investigate the collapse of the World Trade Center 7, I thought it was quite an honor. And I've put together a team that I feel is really, really good. Dr. Fang Shao, who is a postdoctoral researcher who did his PhD under my work, and then Zili Kwan, who is a PhD student now. And because of this project, I've redirected his research effort, and he's going to be looking at fires on high-rise buildings and particularly steel structures. So that being said, let me take you to this first slide and focus your attention onto the blue outline. And we're looking at the plan view of the floor 13. Column 79 is not identified there, but you see column 76 and 78. And if you remember that picture of the building falling a moment ago, if we rotated this 180 degrees and put the blue on the left and the stuff on the right, that blue area represents the NIST's approximation of connections for this building. The portion on the left of this plan view, they chose not to put any of the connections into their finite element model, which indicates that the section to the left is much stiffer than the section to your right. Furthermore, they didn't approximate the stiffness of the connectors on the exterior part of the building. Now, what does that physically mean to you and I? What it means is when you heat up a bar, the bar is going to try to elongate. And it will elongate without resistance, no matter what, unless there's some place that's stiffer than another. If it's fixed on one end and free on the other, it's going to move to the right, imagining fixed being on your left. If I was to put fixed on your right and free on your left, it would expand to your left. Now, if I fix it on both ends, it can literally tear itself apart with a fairly low temperature. So here's the situation on this building. When this modeled it, they did not model it correctly because there are connections everywhere. And so that means part of this building was treated more stiff than the other part. And if remember when you saw the thing come down, what happened is part of the building was coming down differently than the other part. That should have given them a clue right away. That's not what really happened. Take a look at this picture right here. See that red line down? The left part is where they modeled the connections. The right part, they did not. So the left part, when it starts to fall, is coming down fairly rapidly, but the right part is really, really stiff. And so it's not anywhere simulating what really happened in the real building. So that immediately should have told them that this model that they were trying to use to argue that the fire brought this building down was wrong right away. And from the first time I saw this, I was wondering, what in the world is wrong with this model? And it wasn't until a few weeks ago we identified the real cause of this, you know, and that's through this process, because we've modeled every connection. So let's examine the NIST approach for a moment. They've said there's more than 5.5 inches of movement at that girder to push it off the bearing, and so that the column was no longer resisted there. Well, you can imagine that being real, real stiff on one side, the amount of movement that was occurring was going to accumulate over that length, whereas actually the more stiffer part is near column 79. It didn't move hardly at all. So the issues that led to that 5.5-inch movement primarily were due to the fact that they didn't model the connections properly. And there's some question in my mind about even in the place where they did model the connections, they were not connected and properly substructured within the model itself. I realize I may be using words that you're not familiar with, and I apologize for that. But what I'm really trying to say is that in the real structure, they had bolts, and they had these connections putting beams to girders and so forth. And on part of their model, they didn't include those. On the other part, they did, or they attempted to. We did everywhere. So the issues that led to the 5.5 inches of movement and more, it was actually more than that, was they treated the girders as non-composite. In other words, what they did when they looked at the thermal expansion, they didn't include the concrete slab in it. That was totally wrong. They separated the connection modeling. That was wrong. They missed the wide flange stiffeners. That was wrong. So giving you kind of a comparative narrative of what we did versus what they did, our floor framing steel connections were addressed by using the word springs, that basically there's some resistance to the bolt and how that is resisting movement up and down, and there's some resistance to rotation and all that kind of stuff. We addressed that in these connectors. So in this table, you'll see they did it partially, in other words, over part of the floor system. We did it everywhere. Exterior steel framing connections were included by us, but were not by them. In other words, there was a sense of stiffness that was not correct. Girder to column stiffener plates were included by us, not by them. The floor composite with beams, we said they were composite. We also said they were not composite. We wanted to look at all extremes to make a comparison between whether we could simulate what they did or not. The floors with composite beams and girders were examined by us, yes, not by them. And by the way, I think you can imagine that even if they were not composite, the concrete deck is fairly heavy. It's going to be sitting on the beams and the girders. And so to slide the concrete with respect to the steel, there's a lot of friction. And so it's going to take a huge amount of effort to make that happen, to slide without those two working together. And our analysis shows that that couldn't have happened. Okay? The thermal expansion of the concrete deck was included by us. It was not by them. Thermal conductivity expansion for the material properties, we included what we believe to be the aggregate that was used in the construction. And the aggregate type is significantly affects the thermal conductivity and the thermal expansion of the concrete. So we tried to make sure that we had an understanding of what may have occurred truly on that day. The thermal horizontal movement of column 79, it was more than 5.5 inches. I gave him credit here. It was more than that. But it was less than 2 inches by us. And let me also share with you this. We had a quality control program on every single day. My doctoral graduate and my PhD student, we meet every single day. We talk about what we've done. We criticize each other's effort. We make sure that we can justify every piece scientifically. And so as part of this, we use two different computer finite element programs, two different ones. And we did that for a reason. We cross-checked each other's work through looking at each other's models, and then we also ran them using two different programs. One of these gave us 1.9 plus inches, and the other was 1.85 inches instead of the 2 inches. That's why I said it's... So both programs gave us less than 2 inches.
Dr. Halsey, let me ask you a question. You listed here for us 8 or 10 very specific things that they didn't do or that they did incorrectly. Based on your own professional judgment, do you think that that falls within the realm of simple incompetence? Or do you believe that this demonstrates a pattern that is so gross that it had to have been done intentionally?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how anybody could think that this was a cover-up and know anything about finite elements and know structural engineering to think that they could get away with that.
Right. But if one of your PhD students submitted this to you, would you have flunked them?
Yes. So my answer to you today is that the fire did not bring this building down.
Let me ask this. If you could, on a scale of 1 to 100, what do you think the possibility is of this particular building failing with the data with regard to these specific fires? On a scale of 1 to 100, how probable do you think it is, or how possible do you think it is, that this building could have collapsed because of the fires?
Zero.
My reaction to what you've had to say is, of course. And in fact, as soon as you were given the problem of trying to just study, you know, why this building went down, it seems like you didn't really need to do anything. You could have looked at the video and seen and come to a conclusion at that time. Wouldn't you agree that that's true?
I would agree that I knew that there was something wrong with that computer model.
Okay.
I did not know whether it was a fire-related issue or not.
All right. What I'm asking you is, you knew that that was controlled demolition as soon as you saw it the first time.
I can't say that, and I won't even say that yet today.
Okay. So you were allowing for the possibility that that building came down as a result of something other than controlled demolition. Is that what you're saying?
What I said from the day one when I took this on is that I may not be able to tell you what brought it down, but I'll tell you what didn't bring it down.
It seems to me that it's obvious simply from looking at the video that that's controlled demolition. Dan Rather didn't make that up, because he was being creative. He was reacting to his knowledge of life and his views of these things happening for as many times as he'd seen them. And I want to know if that was not your state of mind when you took on this problem.
Let me be very clear. I have a requirement to put away whatever my feelings might be and present to you pure science on what we're going to end up with. So we're not done with this. What we're going to look at are a lot of possible scenarios that may bring this building down, including pulling out columns as we move forth in the next few months. I will be able to tell you, when I get through this process, a lot more about this issue. And then it'll be based on a science answer, not on my feelings.
And again, that was Professor Leroy Hulsey, structural engineer at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, discussing his ongoing research into the collapse of World Trade Center 7. To learn more about Dr. Hulsey's work, and to learn more about World Trade Center 7, you can go to the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth website, which is ae911truth.org. And this concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
As the membership and resources of unions have continued to dwindle, the question is, what are the positions of the unions and what can organized labor do to advocate for its workers against the likely assaults by the Republican juggernaut? Now, we're joined by Chris Brooks, a staff writer, researcher with Labor Notes, a media and organizing project that has been the voice of union activists who want to put the movement back in the labor movement since 1979, to talk about whether organized labor shows signs of returning to class struggle unionism, to a no-shortcuts approach to organizing that centers labor's relevance and strength on the capacity of workers themselves to take collective action in day-to-day battles with management. Chris Brooks.
Thanks for having me.
President-elect Trump starts his term with the opportunity to fill 2 out of 5 positions immediately on the National Labor Relations Board. He's got the federal courts, a Supreme Court position. So, Chris Brooks, your observations and concerns about the assaults the working class is likely to face, and how can they possibly weather the challenge that is upon us? And that's a big question, but I know that you are up to accepting the challenge to its answer.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, Trump said he was going to drain the swamp, but it should be clear to everyone the reptiles are as firmly in control of Washington as they've ever been. And it's not just Washington, right? So the Republicans have taken over not only both houses of Congress and the White House, but a majority of governorships across the country and over 2/3 of the state legislatures. So labor's problems don't begin and end in Washington, but they're actually expanded all throughout the United States at this point. And what we're likely to see in the upcoming administration is national right-to-work legislation, as well as Supreme Court decisions that could force right-to-work across the country, which would remove the requirement that union members pay for the benefits of union representation. And as we've seen in states that have recently gone right to work, like Indiana, Wisconsin, and Michigan, decades of business as usual unionism has left the majority of the labor movement ill-prepared to be able to deal with these kinds of circumstances. So unfortunately, if things continue the way that they're going, many labor unions are going to be scrambling to try to just survive another day. And we need to be able to position ourselves not just to play defense, but to actually go on the offense, to be able to take on this administration as well as the overall prerogatives of corporate America, which has, you know, been firmly in control and with both Republicans and Democrats in the driver's seat, you know, for decades now. That requires us to think differently about our labor unions and for labor leaders to start acting differently.
Well, one of the things that's been troubling, and it comes out of, to some degree, fear, some degree out of bureaucratization and a less active rank and file within the organized labor movement. But I do want you to talk about the many unions that have been pushed into a kind of business unionism where they seek to accommodate the employer and essentially have adopted a don't rock the boat or fatalistic attitude when it comes to strikes or fighting rollbacks in benefits. Talk about the prevalence of accommodation and appeasement of those unions that have effectuated the service-based model of business unionism, because that's part of the struggle as well.
Yeah, and I want to be fair. I mean, it's really hard to organize, right? And in a lot of cases, you're going up against literally the most powerful organizations that have ever existed in the history of the world, right? So you're talking about ExxonMobil, right? You're talking about Walmart. You're talking about these massive corporations that have immense amounts of money and political power. And so many labor leaders, you know, unions themselves are kind of a divided soul. In some ways, there's union as the institution and the union as the movement. And labor leaders often see themselves as stewards of the institution. And so they think that their primary goal and objective should be just to survive another day, to protect what they have, right? And that the institution is there to provide these services to members, to provide very basic protections. And if they're doing that, then they're doing their job. But then unions also have this other history as a movement, right, of actually being able to create a vision for what a different world is and providing the capacity to workers to be able to do that. Unfortunately, when labor leaders fall into the role of just being stewards of the institution, that can lead them down a path of making a lot of really bad decisions. So a good example of that currently is Andy Stern, the former president of the SEIU, is now lobbying on behalf of business interests in order to pass legislation in New York State that he claims would provide benefits to gig economy workers, but would actually just kind of further the misclassification that's rampant in the industry. So what I mean by that is that organizations like Uber have over a $60 billion valuation. It's insane. I mean, it's higher than many manufacturing companies that have, you know, like Honda, for example, in the United States or something like that, you know, like or Ford, you know, this big car company that has multiple assembly lines everywhere and employs, you know, thousands of workers. Uber's worth more than that because of the speculation that exists in Wall Street right now. At the heart of the Uber strategy is to say that the drivers aren't employees, they're independent contractors. That means that Uber drivers have to pay the employer side of the Social Security and Medicare tax. They're not, they don't qualify for the protections provided under basic labor laws, so minimum wage, overtime, the right to organize or collectively bargain. And so these workers are falling through a major crack where they're actually provided, you know, oftentimes they make below minimum wage. They're working well over 40 hours a week and have no benefits or rights. And unfortunately, multiple unions have come to the table to work with this company to say, you know what, we're not going to challenge the misclassification question if you'll allow us to be able to extract dues from these members, if you allow us to represent them in name or theory. So in New York, we've seen the Independent Drivers Guild, which has been created by the machinists, which is exactly that. They literally, the machinists sat down as a union and they created a secret deal, like literally like the drivers themselves can't even read it, with the company that says that they have the right to represent these workers, and in the exchange, they won't challenge misclassification, and they'll lobby on behalf of Uber to advance its interests in the state capitol to pass legislation. So I don't think that these labor leaders, you know, I think that a lot of times that they probably start off in the right place. They share the interests of the workers at some point in time. Then they come to make a series of bad decisions, and then something like this comes to seem as reasonable to them. But really what they're doing is working, you know, becoming a junior partner with corporate America and making sure that workers are subordinate to the management on the job. Another, you know, good example of this is David Rolf. He's kind of the poster child for it with the SEIU Local 775 out west. He's created something called the Workers Lab, and he argues that the future of labor isn't in striking. It's not in organizing on the job and learning how to challenge companies. It's literally adopting the ethos and the values of venture capital. So this Workers Lab he's created tries to teach labor leaders how to hold incubators and come up with apps. And, you know, they bring in business school professors and academics to try to teach business school model techniques to labor leaders. And you know, he likes to go and rub elbows with foundation program officers. And this sounds really sexy and nice to Democrats. But it doesn't fundamentally shift the balance of power in society around the job for workers. And it's not an actual strategy that's going to result in any change. It's just a further re-entrenchment of what exists currently. And it really just moves labor leaders into a position of seeing themselves as junior partners with corporate America.
So in order for a union strategy, I certainly believe, to counter the full court press of the Trump courts, federal and supreme, the Senate, the House, the National Labor Relations Board, a reactionary Secretary of Labor, and Capitol, what is a poor union to do? Well, it seems to me that you've written about, and I want you to begin the discussion of, how does pity the poor worker. How does the individual worker begin to respond to this, what I called previously juggernaut, but also this union business, this model that you've talked about, a model of appeasement and accommodation? Is there a left pole, a kind of injury to one is an injury to all mentality that has excited you, that you have seen prevalent in the working class organizations at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. So many workers are stuck in the position of not only having to organize on the job against the boss, but having to organize within their own unions, right, to create an alternative vision of what their union can be. But there were really great examples of rank and file leaders that have been able to do that. So one good example is the Chicago Teachers Union. The Chicago Teachers Union was taken over by a group called the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, or CORE, a few years back. And what these teachers did is they got together and they said, you know what, our union is not up to the challenge at this point. It's not organized enough. It's not militant enough. It's not willing to take on the boss and win. And in their case, the boss actually happens to be the establishment Democrats who run the city of Chicago. So they ran for election on a different vision. They began organizing in their schools and on the job, and they won. They won the election. Karen Lewis, being the leader now of the Chicago Teachers Union, who ran on the core caucus, is Jesse Sharkey, the vice president there, multiple representatives at the school level all the way up the chain. So this was a great example of workers coming together to create a caucus to represent their interests, to get elected to leadership with a different vision. And what they did is they pivoted the union away from business as usual unionism towards this idea of being militant, of being progressive, and of being more democratic. So they began actively organizing on the job, giving the skills and resources they needed at the lowest level for their own members to be able to take on the principals, to be able to take on the supervisors, and you know, around fight on the issues that they care about on a day-to-day basis, and then connecting those workplace struggles to a broader issue-based struggle of what's happening in the community and what they want to see addressed in the contract negotiations. You might remember in 2012, the Chicago Teachers Union went on strike, and it just riveted the nation. It was one of the most powerful and inspiring strikes we've seen in years, and they were able to successfully connect their workplace struggles to the broader attacks that were happening by these, you know, establishment corporate Democrats, you know, with their neoliberal policies all throughout the city of Chicago. So the consolidation and closing of schools and communities of color, the use of tax policies to redirect revenue away from public services and public schools towards developers and companies. And they were able to connect the dots between what they were fighting for at the table and what the community on the whole wanted. So, you know, when teachers go on strike, it could be a major inconvenience to parents, right, whose kids are no longer in school and they're having to go to work. But when they hit the streets and the school system closed down, over 75% of Chicago's parents sided with the teachers against Rahm Emanuel. That's incredible. And so, you know, you fast forward to 2016 and the most recent contract negotiations that they just settled, the teachers didn't demobilize. In the last 4 years, they've been actively fighting on the job, continuing to promote this vision for what they think Chicago's public schools should be. They've been engaging in civil disobedience. They've been bringing in lawsuits. They've been picketing up at the mayor's house with parents. And this is decentralized, right? Not all of this is coordinated or controlled by the union's leadership, but it's actively inspiring and encouraging the rank-and-file members themselves to plan their own actions to do these things and to ask the union for whatever resources they need to make them happen. So when 2016 hits, the Chicago public school system knows the teachers mean business. They know that they're not joking, that when they say that they're going to go on strike and the community is going to support them, that they're right. And so the Chicago teachers were capable of winning two significant concessions in this round of negotiations. One is they put a cap on charter schools in the union contract. And that's the first time in the history of the country that a teachers union has been able to do that. And they were able to redirect $88 million of tax revenue back to Chicago public schools, which is incredible, specifically out of this TIF program, this tax incremental financing program that was created by the mayor to legitimately, like literally just take the property taxes that should be going to schools and public services and give them to developers and corporations. They were able to seize the money back. And what's interesting about both of these major concessions they won is that neither one of them that were legally allowable under the law to strike over. So you can see how the union was willing to step up and actually do something that, you know, illegal, break the law, break the rules, in order to win something that would have had massive community support. And this, none of this would have been possible if they hadn't made the significant investment in the rank and file, if they hadn't been literally having thousands of conversations in the schools, if they hadn't been engaging in collective action constantly and consistently and encouraging rank and file to take ownership and responsibility for enacting this vision that they have.
Well, one of the things that also excited me in your writing was a piece that was done called Growing Numbers of Union Activists Going to the Mat for Black Lives Matter. And you talk about Osman Dumas. And I want you to do that here. Osman Dumas is a housekeeper at a nursing home. And perhaps one of the most significant questions that was asked, which has everything to do with how does one successfully fight the repressive juggernaut that is anti-labor and really respond to the war on the workers. And he talked about he wasn't really sure what the union was about until his shop steward, Lakeisha Collins, began to speak to him about the things they were doing. Now tell the story of what they were doing and how Osman Dumas got involved. And perhaps this really builds bridges, if you will, between the issues of the economic bread and butter issues that unions are proverbially involved with and the full identity of a person, the racial identity, the racial profiling, the police brutality, the issue of inequality of income and homelessness and all of these issues that give for a full and robust person and draw the labor movement together with the community sphere that people organizing where you live, where you work, coming together. So am I?
Yeah.
Is that part of what that article is about and what you feel stimulates a left pole in labor to begin to create that spark of energy and evoke the class consciousness to be able to fight what is ahead of the workers' movement?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a great example, right? So this is the SEIU Healthcare in Illinois. A staff representative went to Lakeisha Collins, a well-respected young black female shop steward, and said, we're interested in helping to create a program to help, you know, engage more young workers. You have any ideas on this? And she said, yeah, I'd like to take that on. So she started meeting with some of her coworkers, and they came up with this idea of, you know, we need to do more to start being involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. So they started to think about what that could look like. They started going to rallies as SEIU members, trying to see what other members were there, talking to them about what they wanted. And the first thing they came up with was a Know Your Rights training, where they said, you know what, we need to teach our members about their rights that they have when they're being approached by the police, and the rights that their family and friends have. And so the first training they had, they had, you know, well over 100 people attend. It was a huge event they thought was very successful. And what they recognized is that, you know, that I can't separate my identity as a black person when I walk into the doors of a business and when I go home. Like, it doesn't begin and end, right, in one area but not the other. And that the union, to be relevant to my life, needs to be able to help me navigate both of these worlds, right? It needs to be able to provide me with the resources that I need in order to survive in both. And so they started to create this organization called the Future Fighters that actively works to support their black SEIU members as they're trying to fight for police accountability, as they're trying to deal with issues of poverty and inequality in their communities. And it was through that, you know, organization that she was empowered to create within the SEIU, that she began to recruit more and more young black folks to the organization, people like Osmond, who went to his very first Black Lives Matter protest because of the SEIU, who learned about the union from Lakeisha, but also said, like, you know, that the connection for him wasn't because of the contract protections. It was because he saw that the people who were getting beaten by the police in the notorious cases that are all too common on the television, they look like him. They could be him. They could be his brother. They could be his cousin. And he saw the union standing up to do something about it. So the union's relevance was directly tied to not just what it was capable of doing for us on the job, but is creating the channel through which he could actually fight for these broader issues in his community. And I think this goes back to this vision that we have for labor's left pole, for the idea that labor to revitalize itself in the contemporary era needs to be progressive. It needs to fight for a political vision that challenges the current establishment. It needs to be militant, meaning it needs to be able to step up its tactics and to be more abrasive, to fight for what it believes in. And it needs to be democratic. It needs to provide the rank and file itself with the resources it needs to be able to create its own vision. And so in this case, you see all of those things coming together in a way that was really conducive for growing the membership of the union, for making it more relevant to the ties, and then for helping it to have stronger connections to the community organizations that are fighting on all these other issues. And this is relevant because we know that, you know, the boss that's screwing you on the job has, you know, the same interests and probably the same connections to the landlord that's raising your rent, right? So as the boss is trying to keep your wages low, the landlord's raising your wages up. They have a shared interest with each other. They're probably working with each other, networking with each other in the political climate. And it's important for unions to recognize that they have to deal with all these issues. And they can only do that if the leadership is capable of letting go of the reins and allowing more of the members to take over.
And I'm going to take a line from Labor Notes where it was said, "We won't sugarcoat it. 2017 looks rough. The labor movement is going to have a fight on its hands. It's going to have to fight harder than ever to defeat the anti-worker propaganda that's heading our way, including national right to work. But we can do more than just play defense against anti-union attacks. We want to win victories that matter to our families, coworkers, and communities. We need to make 2017 a year of troublemaking and boat rocking against the corporate Goliaths. Call it the year of the slingshot. And that's precisely what we're going to do. And we want to thank you for your good writing. And I encourage listeners to get in touch with Labor Notes. Read it. It really has been the voice, as I said, since 1979 of activism in the workplace, in the organized labor movement, and for a democratic rank and file to assume its rightful control over its unions and the working class to assume power over the society. They create the wealth. Thank you for being with us, and we've been speaking with Chris Brooks, and make sure you keep in touch with his writing. He's an excellent young writer.
Thank you, Mimi. I appreciate it.
This is for all you big government Wall Street types.
Well, I was watching TV at election time. There were two candidates trying to lay it on the line. One of them looked like he was training to be cute. He was a white man in a business suit. I looked at the other, he was equally astute. He was a white man in a business suit. Well, they kept on talking, they didn't make sense. They both seemed to be on the same side of the fence. There was no real debate, it was a phony dispute. They were just two white men in business suits. If you want to be the president, better learn to salute and be a white man in a business suit. He's a white man in a business suit. If a single one of them are in cahoots, he's running the U.S., Europe, and Russia, too. He's a white man in a business suit.
President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet is already the richest in modern history. With at least four billionaires, including Trump and several multimillionaires, they include private equity investor Wilbur Ross as Commerce Secretary, philanthropist and Republican Party fundraiser Betsy DeVos as Education Secretary, and Linda McMahon, who co-founded World Wrestling Entertainment, Inc., as Small Business Administrator. Just those four alone have a combined net worth of at least $12 billion. That's more than the annual gross domestic product of about 50 small countries. Trump's cabinet also includes a host of climate change skeptics and deniers, including Trump's pick to lead the EPA, Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt, who wants to scrap the Clean Power Plan, Rick Perry as head of the agency he wants about to scrap, the Department of Energy, and Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, who is Trump's pick as Secretary of State. You may also have noticed some common traits overall among Trump's nominees. Most are white, extremely wealthy men, with just four women announced so far, and a limited selection of minorities. And while the cabinet does contain a healthy number of outsiders, many are picks from Wall Street, such as Stephen Bannon as chief strategist and Steven Mnuchin as Treasury Secretary, and ex-military men like John Kelly as head of Homeland Security and James Mattis as Secretary of Defense, as well as a handful of establishment Republicans. Not exactly draining the swamp, as Trump promised to do during his campaign. In fact, responding to the apparent contradictions in Trump's cabinet picks so far, Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown recently quipped, "This isn't draining the swamp, it's stocking it with alligators." Whoops.
Suits. That was put together by Mike Stout, and thanks to U.S. Labor Against the War.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
They played Old Anxi at the Black Cat, and all of a sudden, they were in there in plain clothes, grabbing people. Nobody knew who they were yet. The police were beating people in there, beating them down. When you're my age and ready to leave this earth, if you haven't left your community in a better place than you found it, and the world as a whole, you haven't lived.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. An Australian Senate committee steers toward marriage equality, Japan bans LGBTQ harassment by government workers, and honoring the black cat that scratched cops before Stonewall. Those stories and more this week, now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending February 18th, 2017. Australian equality advocates were encouraged this week by a cross-party Senate committee report on how to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. The process had actually started prior to what turned out to be the failed effort to hold a national plebiscite on the issue. Assuming the public vote was in favor, which was expected, the committee was drafting a civil marriage equality bill to then be introduced in Parliament. Greens Senator Janet Rice joined members of the Liberal, Labour, and National parties on the committee, along with the representative from a small group of independent MPs, to issue the report. She described it as an unprecedented show of collaboration, negotiation, and consensus that has given us a way forward to achieve marriage equality in this Parliament. Labour's leader in the Senate, partnered lesbian mom Penny Wong, applauded the committee's cross-party cooperation in a discussion that, she said, is so often mired in partisanship, acrimony, and finger-pointing. We must now take the next steps to work together, she added, to end this debate and to achieve what is the will of the overwhelming majority of the Australian people. Members of the House of Representatives were said to be reviewing the Senate committee's report.
The most important area of consensus in the Senate report, and perhaps the most contentious, was how to balance civil liberties with religious rights. The committee recommends that ministers and other religious officiants be exempt from anti-discrimination laws if their faith does not recognize civil marriage equality. A separate category of religious marriage celebrants would also be created to allow civil servants who are religiously opposed to marrying same-gender couples to opt out of performing them. However, the ruling coalition government of Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull resolutely refuses to allow its MPs a free vote on any civil marriage equality bill that comes before Parliament. While a few Liberal Party lawmakers are on record in support of equality, the government's further right coalition partner, National Party, helped form the government on the condition that a national popular vote would be the only path to civil marriage equality. A coalition of opposition parties blocked the government's proposal to hold that plebiscite. Turnbull insisted soon thereafter that the issue of civil marriage equality in Australia was dead for the foreseeable future. Stay tuned.
The U.S. State of Washington Supreme Court ruled unanimously this week that a florist who refused to provide services for a gay couple's wedding in 2013 broke anti-discrimination laws. She claimed that doing so would violate her religious beliefs. Baronelle Stutzman had previously sold the couple flowers and knew they were gay. However, she told them that she couldn't sell them flowers for their wedding because the marriage of a same-gender couple was incompatible with her Christian beliefs. A lower court ordered her to pay a $1,000 fine for refusing to serve the couple. Her appeal to the state high court failed because the justices found that providing flowers for a same-gender wedding ceremony did not constitute her endorsement of civil marriage equality. Stutzman had already acknowledged in court documents that providing flowers for the wedding of a Muslim couple wouldn't be an endorsement of Islam, nor would providing flowers for an atheist couple endorse atheism, the justices noted. Stutzman's lawyers, from the far-right Alliance Defending Freedom, which the Southern Poverty Law Center officially labeled a hate group this week, said they'd be appealing her case to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Japan's National Personnel Authority has issued changes on regulations against sexual harassment at government ministries and agencies to explicitly state that discriminatory speech and behavior toward LGBT people is sexual harassment. The new rules apply to some 280,000 federal government workers, and violators will reportedly be harshly punished. Officials at the NPA said examples of such violations would include saying that homosexuals are sickening, calling someone a man-woman, or saying, you're not married because you're gay. Equality activists, who claim that such harassment is pervasive, hailed the new regulations and called for similar moves by local governments and private employers.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump continues to send mixed signals on a number of policy positions, including LGBT rights. Trump has already decided to keep the anti-discrimination protections for LGBT federal workers instituted under President Obama. And it was announced this week that openly gay Randy Berry, the State Department's LGBT rights envoy under President Obama, will stay on in that post in the current administration. He'll continue to be the State Department's point person on LGBT rights abroad.
But Trump's newly installed Attorney General Jeff Sessions has pulled the federal government's legal support for Obama-era guidelines on the equal treatment of transgender students in public schools. Sessions has a long anti-queer record, so while equality activists are saddened by the move, they're not surprised. Implementation of the guidelines had been stalled by a lawsuit filed by a dozen Republican-dominated states challenging the Obama administration's assertion that federal civil rights laws banning discrimination based on sex apply to bias based on gender identity. A number of federal courts have already agreed with that analysis. Oral arguments in the case were scheduled to begin on February 21st. But rather than continuing to defend the guidelines, the Justice Department asked this week for an indefinite postponement. Those transgender student protections will apparently never see the light of day because the lawsuit to settle the issue will never be heard. Critics note the irony of the federal agency tasked with protecting civil rights now seemingly working instead to undercut them. Attorney General Sessions is not likely to support transgender Virginia teen Gavin Grimm in his historic March 28th lawsuit before the U.S. Supreme Court. Grimm, who identifies as male, was denied access to the boys' bathrooms on his high school campus. It will be the first time a transgender rights case is heard by the nation's highest court.
Meanwhile, an undocumented transgender woman in Texas has been swept up in the Trump administration's pogrom against undocumented people. Irvin Gonzalez was targeted for deportation right after she successfully filed domestic violence charges against her abusive ex-boyfriend. Gonzalez, a Mexican citizen living in El Paso, was arrested at the county courthouse for immigration law violations just minutes after winning a restraining order against the ex. County Attorney Joanne Bernal told local media that she had been kicked, punched, slapped. She had been chased around with a knife. So she came to our office seeking a protective order and seeking protection from her partner. Gonzalez was taken into custody literally on the courthouse steps. Bernal told the El Paso Times that the tip about Gonzalez's whereabouts probably came from her ex-boyfriend and alleged abuser, who had been detained by ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, earlier in the day.
Gonzalez may not be a poster person for the undocumented or for transgender rights. A spokeswoman for ICE said she's been deported several times since 2010 for at least 8 convictions on charges including false imprisonment, assault, and illegal reentry. But El Paso District Attorney Jaime Esparza said that the arrest of a Gonzalez sends a horrible message to victims of domestic violence on whether or not they're actually going to have the ability to seek justice in the courthouse. Stephanie Carr of El Paso's Center Against Sexual and Family Violence, where Gonzalez had reportedly been living, said her organization had received multiple phone calls from other undocumented survivors asking if they too will be arrested. El Paso County Judge Veronica Escobar joined Carr and leaders of several other domestic violence agencies expressing grave concerns that the arrest will keep people living with abusive partners from getting help. Abusers often threaten to alert ICE to their battered undocumented partners if they complain to authorities.
But finally, and happily, on a far lighter note, it was revealed this week that the Chinese government, through its state-controlled newspaper Beijing News, is a substantial stakeholder in one of the country's leading gay dating apps, Blued. A reported 7 million users log in every day. That's more than the Western world's Grindr, which is banned by the Chinese government, by the way. Blued reportedly has an astounding 27 million users overall. The Beijing News investment was the equivalent of $4.36 million. As it turns out, the state-backed newspaper invested about the same amount in the company in 2014. Blued has not only been profitable, it's expanded into international markets with e-commerce, live streaming, gaming, and entertainment services. The company's founder and CEO, Gang Li, told reporters that the gay business is a piece of virgin territory in China, and we hope to become a leader of this lucrative market. Political ideology aside, the bottom line is apparently the bottom line. NewNowNext.com reported this week that both Grindr and Hornet, the latter of which already has a strategic user-sharing agreement with Blued, have received millions of dollars from Chinese gaming companies that want to reach LGBT consumers.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 18th, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
Well, folks, we'll be back in a minute with more excitement right after this word.
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, it's no laughing matter what Congress could do to our civil rights. An informed community is a strong community. That's why I'm inviting you to tune in to this station to hear This Way Out.
Hey, this reminds me of something. You know, I didn't organize tonight's event, but I did organize another event 50 years ago on this night.
Contrary to what you may have heard, there was more to LGBTQ activism before the 1969 Stonewall Uprising in New York than cringing in closets. Brave homosexuals had begun picketing in Washington, D.C. against discriminatory federal employment practices in 1965. And over on the left coast, a police raid not unlike the infamous one at the Stonewall Inn led to one of the community's first organized demonstrations. The 50th anniversary of that momentous event was celebrated in Los Angeles earlier this month. And This Way Out's Abby Dees got the story inside and out.
Before Stonewall, LGBT people were indeed fighting for their rights. And on February 11, 1967, at the Black Cat Tavern in Silver Lake, a gay-friendly neighborhood in Los Angeles, Alexei Romanov helped organize the first large gay rights protest on record. But you could say that this story begins almost three decades earlier in New York City.
Bryant Park in New York, that used to be a gay hangout. Way back then, my mother was in show business, and there was a group of about nine of us, and we were kids. I was 14. I think it went up to about 15 and down to about 9 years or 10 years old. We would hang out in Bryant Park, and we called ourselves the Trunkers because we were born in a trunk, theater term. So we called ourselves the Trunkers. And there was a man, to this day I don't know his name, but he changed my life. I called him Mother Brian. We all called him Mother Brian, because that was kind of a term of endearment for a gay man. He was 86 at that time. He would tell us what it was like when he was 18 years old in 1890 to be a gay man. Then he would go for one meal whenever he came over, down to Horn and Hart's Automat, down on 42nd Street. And he would sit there and talk to us and tell us about things. And one day, there was about six of us sitting there with him. We would have a Coke or a soda. And he said, when you're my age and ready to leave this earth, if you haven't left your community in a better place than you found it, and the world as a whole, you haven't lived. And it just touched my heart. That has been a key to what changed my life at 14. Mother Brian.
I would like you to tell me a story of the early hours of the morning, January 1st, 1967, at the Black Cat Tavern in Silver Lake.
There had been somewhat of a police truce for the past 2 years. Reagan had taken office that night, New Year's Eve, as governor of California. And they raided, I think it was four bars that night. One of the bars was the New Faces. Another bar, I believe, was the Ram's Head Inn. And another bar was the Little Cave, and then the Black Cat. That raid was very violent. Now, no bars had windows to the open because we had to be closeted and we had to block off the general public from looking in. Nothing tawdry was going on in those bars. Those bars were about getting together with your own community and people you cared about and knew. So at midnight, they played Old Anxiety at the Black Cat. Everybody was there enjoying themselves, and all of a sudden, the police raided the place. They were in there in plain clothes. They were grabbing people. Nobody knew who they were yet. There was no fighting, but the police were beating people in there, beating them down. And the charges that came out of that was lewd conduct, meaning that they had kissed on New Year's Eve for, I forget how many seconds longer than was permissible by law.
This is Abby Dees, and I'm talking with Alexei Romanov about the Black Cat Tavern protest for gay rights in 1967. And then what happened?
We didn't have computers, we didn't have cell phones, but we had phones. And we had a thing that we called a phone tree. That's where I would call 10 people, and they would call another 10 people, and those 10 people would call 20 people, and it would spread like that. That's how we got word through the community. It may sound like we were very organized, but we weren't.
What was motivating you? Because this wasn't the first time that you had experienced a police raid or harassment, and certainly it was nothing new to the community. Why this time?
Maybe the amount of injury that happened, all the people that ended up in hospitals, that was uncalled for because they didn't fight back. They just grabbed people. In those days, if you were arrested for lewd conduct, there were two charges you could be charged with. There was a major charge, and I think it was 640-something A, and then there was a lesser charge, which was 640-something B. What they were hoping for, that you would plead guilty to 647B because it was a lesser charge and you wouldn't have to register as a sex offender for the rest of your life. So they would plead guilty to the lesser offense, pay a fine, and get out of there as the best they could. And you got to understand, we had a mental illness in those days and we could be committed by our own families. They could just not like what we were doing, and they could put us in a sanitarium for many, many years.
So this was the environment that you were in. You started the phone tree, and then what happened?
The phone tree started working, and it took us to February 11th, 1967, to have the demonstration. There was a bar in Hollywood that was the only place that would allow us to meet, but we had to meet while they were closed.
Was the phone tree saying, okay, we're going to have a meeting, we're trying to get people together? Did you know what you were going to do with
No, we got together in order to discuss what we would do. Because you have to understand, we were terrified because if we were exposed and in the newspapers or anything, we would lose our jobs, we would lose our income, we would lose our homes, and our families would alienate us because of embarrassment. Because a lot of people came from other places to be anonymous. That's why the big cities attracted the gay people. Mother Bryan told me in 1890, the police didn't want to put you in jail, but they would come and beat you up with their billy clubs if they knew you were gay every day until you moved out of their city. Get you out of here, anywhere else but here.
So how many people showed up to just discuss what was going to happen?
About 30, 35 people. And it was brought up that 3 months earlier on the Sunset Strip, there had been an anti-war demonstration. And the people were attacked by the sheriff's department and they were beat so bad. And these are heterosexuals just protesting the war. So you can imagine how we felt. They wouldn't give a darn if we really got injured.
Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA.
Hello, I'm Robbie Kaplan, the author of Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. And you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
This is Abby Dees, and I'm talking with Alexei Romanov about the Black Cat Tavern protest for gay rights in 1967, 2 years before the Stonewall Inn riots.
There were 500 to 600 gay men and women and people who supported them demonstrating out there.
How did you get from 30, 35 people meeting in a closed bar in Hollywood to 500, 600 people protesting?
Word of mouth, people being sick and tired of being sick and tired of being sick and tired of being treated the way they were being treated.
So what did you decide on? Did you say we're stand outside with signs?
First of all, you couldn't stand in one place. You have to move. Otherwise, you can be arrested for loitering. We had people who were giving us information about the legality of different things. We produced flyers that we passed out besides the signs. We didn't chant much. We did a little. But We mainly paraded around, and any one of our flyers that were handed out, if we saw it was dropped, we ran over and picked it up.
What did the flyers say, do you recall?
It told why we were there, the story.
Was there news there?
The only people who covered that demonstration and most of the pictures from that demonstration that you see were done by the Free Press. They were the only ones that showed up.
Did you let the media know ahead of time?
Oh, they knew very well what was going to happen. Very well. They didn't want to cover it.
How long did it last?
To the evening.
And how were the police?
Very orderly, because they were being photographed.
And we see the importance of that to this year.
Yes, yes.
Why do you think we don't hear much about this? Other things that were happening around the time was the next year, the patch on PCH had a protest in 1966 in San Francisco. Compton's cafeteria, there was a protest. We tend to think everything started with Stonewall, but it didn't. Why do you think we don't know about this?
The difference was there were demonstrations, and somehow a riot makes more news. And Stonewall was a riot. It wasn't a peaceful, organized demonstration. I never want to lessen the importance of Stonewall, but all of these steps are important because they were all footholds.
When you were protesting that night, were you thinking of Mother Bryant?
Yes. And the funny part was I wasn't thinking about Mother Bryant in the terms you would be proud of me. I was thinking that I'm so proud to have met you in my teen years to shape my life. I mean, that was the most important person in my life. Usually your parents are the most important person. Well, I had a single mother. Mother Bryant was my adopted father. I just loved that man because he made so much sense. And you know, I'm 80 years old now. And he seemed so old to me back then, where he doesn't seem that old to me now, because there's only 6 years difference between him and me at that time and now. But there were people like that in our community. There were people who reached out to us kids. And I think there are people who do that now. I've had a great deal of love in my life, and I've loved a great deal in my life. And I want to know people who are younger or even my age that there's still more to life until you take your last breath. Don't give up. Don't stop. Make sure things end up equal to everything else in the world. When one person in the world doesn't have all of their rights, whatever country they're in, all of us don't have all of our rights.
It's nice to be acknowledged, but I didn't do it to be acknowledged. What I did it for was my own freedom and your freedom, and the people I learned from as a young person are still here in spirit because you're carrying their spirit. Let me hear you. I hope to be here for the 75th.
My name is Alexei Boris Romanov.
And for This Way Out, I'm Abby Dees.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Michael LeBeau, Tanya Kane Perry, and Abby Dees contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. The Tom Robinson Band performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the Estate of Christopher David Trentum, the Gay Chemist Support Fund of Horizons Foundation, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, for making this program possible. It's always a good time to log on to thiswayout.org and join the family. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email twororadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WGDR Plainfield, Vermont, Free Radio San Diego, California, 3MGB Malakuta, Victoria, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you.
studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Not 13 hours, not 130 hours, but over 1,300 hours of voices that changed the world. The voices of people like Gore Vidal and Paul Robeson and Emma Goldman and Fidel Castro and Toni Morrison and Noam Chomsky and Gary Snyder and Joan Baez and Alan Watts and dozens of other thinkers, writers, activists, musicians, performers, critics, poets, and dissenters. It's called Voices That Change the World, and it's the largest collection ever compiled by the Pacifica Radio Archives, and we're presenting portions of it today and offering you the entire collection on a USB drive. It's your amazing high-value thank you gift for a pledge of $200 or more to listener-sponsored KPFA. You can split your pledge into six monthly installments of $16 and change per month, six monthly installments of $16 and change per month. And the phone number, if you want to call, and we hope you will call to support KPFA anytime this hour, is 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732, easily remembered as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You're calling out to us, hey KPFA, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Today you'll hear from Howard Zinn, Edward Said, and Molly Ivins, as well as from a reading of 1984, George Orwell's dystopian novel, sales of which have soared since Trump's inauguration. We begin with Howard Zinn, an historian, writer, and activist. He was a political science professor at Boston University until his retirement in 1988. Zinn, who died in January 2010, is best known for his book, A People's History of the United States, which has encouraged two generations of students, activists, and others to rethink U.S. history from a radical social justice, anti-war, bottom-up perspective. Here's Howard Zinn, who served in World War II.
When I was discharged from the Army, from the Air Force, I got a letter from General Marshall. He was a general of generals. He was sending a letter, not a personal letter to me. Dear Howie. No. A letter that was sent to 16 million men who had served in the armed forces, some women, too. The letter was something like this. We've won the war. Congratulations for your service. It will be a new world. It wasn't a new world. And we know it hasn't been a new world since World War II. War after war after war after war. And 50 million people were dead in that war to end all wars, to end fascism and dictatorship and militarism. Oh, so, yes, I came to a conclusion that war cannot be tolerated. No matter what we're told. And if we think that there are good wars, and it's therefore, well, maybe this is a good war, I wanted to examine the so-called good wars, the holy wars, and take a good look at them and think again about the phenomenon of war and come to the conclusion, yes, war cannot be tolerated. No matter what we're told, no matter what tyrant exists, what border has been crossed, what aggression has taken place, it's not that we're going to be passive in the face of tyranny or aggression. No. But we'll find ways other than war to deal with whatever problems we have. Because war is inevitably the indiscriminate, massive killing of huge numbers of people. And children are a good part of those people. Every war is a war against children. So it's not just getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Think about it. Well, we got rid of Saddam Hussein. And, of course, we killed huge numbers of people who had been victims of Saddam Hussein. When you fight a war against a tyrant, who do you kill? You kill the victims of the tyrant. Anyway, all this was simply to make us think again about war. And to think, you know, we're at war now, right? In Iraq, in Afghanistan, and sort of in Pakistan, since we're sending rockets over there and killing innocent people in Pakistan. And so we should not accept that. We should look for a peace movement to join. Really, look for some peace organization to join. It will look small at first and pitiful and helpless, but that's how movements start. That's how the movement against the Vietnam War started. Started with handfuls of people who thought they were helpless, thought they were powerless. But remember this, the power of the people on top depends on the obedience of the people below. When people stop obeying, they have no power. Now, when workers go on strike, huge corporations lose their power. When consumers boycott, huge business establishments have to give in. When soldiers refuse to fight, as so many soldiers did in Vietnam, so many deserters, so many fraggings, acts of violence by enlisted men against officers in Vietnam, B-52 pilots refusing to fly bombing missions anymore, war can't go on. When enough soldiers refuse, the government has to decide we can't continue. So, yes, people have the power. If they begin to organize, if they protest, if they create a strong enough movement, they can change things.
Howard Zinn, the late great radical historian, author of, among other books, The Paradigm Shifting, A People's History of the United States. We turn now to another voice featured on this 1,300-hour-plus compilation, Voices That Changed the World, the voice of Edward Said. Said was for many years professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. He was also the author of the seminal book, Orientalism. Let's go now to portions of a talk Said gave at UC Berkeley 7 months before his death in September 2003.
Antagonism is the structure that today binds Palestinians with Israelis in the land and in the diaspora. Neither people has been blessed with a Mandela, nor even a de Klerk. We are very far from having a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The number of visionaries who have articulated thoughts that go beyond a wretched, impoverished opposition is tiny, if they exist at all. Yes, there have been Israelis and Palestinians who have tried together to work against injustice and intolerance, but they are a minority. But that need not always be so. And there are other models than that of civil war. Let me finish up on a modest personal note. Not because I want to prophesy a brilliant future, but because circumstances sometimes create new things to see and new models to follow. About a decade ago, through a rather amusing coincidence, I met the great Israeli pianist and conductor, Daniel Barenboim, in the lobby of a London hotel, where we both happened to be staying, he to give a concert with Pierre Boulez at the Barbican Theater, I to give some lectures. We recognized each other and quickly befriended each other, for temperamental reasons, of course, but also, as an amateur pianist and musician, I had a great passion for the art and was fascinated by Barenboim's extraordinary gifts and personality. Music brought us together, but so, of course, did our common background in the Middle East. It turned out that he and his family arrived in Israel from Argentina in 1950, shortly after my extended family had completely left Palestine. Over time, and given our itinerant schedules and illness and other things, despite all that, we developed a very warm and special friendship, one result of which is a book of conversations. It's called Parallels and Paradoxes, a phrase that goes some way to describe the way our interests in music, culture, politics, and the piano and life in general cross and crisscross, sometimes in harmony, sometimes with divergence and difference. Barenboim, as an Israeli, has now visited the encircled and occupied West Bank on his own several times, defying the Israeli army, successfully sometimes, unsuccessfully on other occasions, donating his talents as a great musician to a starved and deprived Palestinian public in Ramallah, where his easy naturalness of being, he has no pompousness, has made him a great number of friends and admirers. No other Israeli or Jewish artist on that level has done anything so generous or compassionate as Barenboim. In addition, he has taken under his wing two tremendously talented young Palestinian pianists, made himself available to them as teacher and mentor, as well as helping to arrange concerts and teachers for them. But the main story I want to tell very quickly here concerns what we've called the Weimar Project, or the East-West Divan. In early 1999, shortly after Weimar had been designated European Cultural Capital for the year, I happened to be in Berlin visiting Barenboim, where he was offered the chance to perform in Weimar during the summer. After a short discussion between us and with Yo-Yo Ma, who also happened to be there, we decided to use the opportunity instead to do something different, namely in facilities generously donated by the Weimar and federal governments. We decided first to audition a whole set of young musicians aged 17 to 25, with one exception, a 10-year-old Palestinian piano prodigy who happens to be my great-nephew. Phenomenal, phenomenal gift. All across the Arab world and Israel. That took about 6 months. By the end of the auditions, we had the makings of several excellent chamber ensembles, as well as a fine orchestra made up of instrumentalists from 7 or 8 Arab countries and Israel. We convened in August of that year, and for 3 weeks they were drilled and rehearsed and fashioned into a remarkably proficient orchestra by Barenboim, who devoted 6, 7, or 8 hours a day to the task, as well as going back and forth 3 times a week to conduct Wagner operas at Bayreuth, which was nearby. My role was to lead nightly discussions in which everyone participated on every subject from music to literature, history, and of course, politics. In Weimar, we were not only generously taken care of by the cultural capital's auspices, but figuratively speaking, we were there under the wing of Goethe, Weimar's most famous inhabitant, who had written in the town his great mature masterpiece, the Westöstlicher Divan, an extraordinary act of homage to Islam generally and to Hafiz, the great Persian poet in particular. Goethe was, I believe, the first great modern European to attempt some kind of artistic synthesis and involvement between what in those days were called the Orient and Europe. His accomplishment was the magnificent Divan itself, as well as for our purposes the use of art, so to speak, to create an imaginative reordering of polarities, differences, and opposition on the basis not of politics, but of affinities, spiritual generosity, and aesthetic self-renewal. We also exposed our students to Buchenwald, one of the most notorious of the Nazi death camps, which lies only about 6 kilometers outside Weimar, thus serving us to point out how very close together the great heights of culture can easily coexist with the deepest and basest evil. The point of all this is that a new paradigm emerged for us and our students, who were, it should go without saying, from differing and sometimes jarringly antagonistic backgrounds, and whose interests, ambitions, histories, and commitments during the 3 weeks were suspended in the interest of music. Music, I don't need to insist on this too much, is a silent art. What and how it articulates in sound are totally independent of the world of ideas, concepts, and words themselves, yet also dependent on them in that those very things suspended by music's enactment are paradoxically the very worldly circumstances that bring musicians together. But that opposition and symbiosis between music and the world, so to speak, proved amazingly fertile. We did another summer in Weimar the next year, 2000. In 2001, we went to Chicago, and last year, and for the next few years, our East-West Divan has been adopted by the Andalusian government as well as a private foundation of three cultures, Seville has become our new home. From Weimar to Seville, with its history of Islamic and Jewish and Christian cultural interaction, is, I believe, a totally different trajectory and paradigm for Arabs and Israelis. There's no political program to what we do, since everything is subordinated to music, which for 3 weeks possesses everyone, in addition, of course, to the practical matter of living and working together. The point of telling you the story is to suggest how, despite the incredibly polarized, antagonistic, and discordant world in which we live, there's always the possibility of another alternative type of social model. Barenboim is no ordinary Israeli, of course, and I like to think perhaps I'm not an ordinary Palestinian either. But in our work and commitment to our friendship and to music making and discussion, and a disruption of the rigid lines that have circumscribed and organized our public as well as private lives, we go on. If it weren't for the rich, emblematic status of Palestine and Israel, however, none of this would have been possible. Since it is because the complex issue itself, whose core, from my point of view, is the struggle for Palestinian human rights in a land sanctified by the three monotheistic religions, is so fertile with possibilities, ones that reach into culture, history, politics, and personal relations, that we have been able to do what we do. Presiding over our efforts, students and teachers alike, has been the spirit of music, which I would want to insist is neither a sentimental panacea nor a facile solution for every problem, but rather a practical utopia whose presence and practice in our riven world is so sorely needed and in all sorts of ways intensely instructive. At least, therefore, another world emerges as a result against the backdrop of Andalusia, itself an alternative model for coexistence between the three monotheisms. And if it isn't immediately available on the world stage, it can at least signal the arrival of a new attitude whose example might soon provide us with many others, many salutary changes, many profound new interpretations of what is now only an appallingly polarized, completely inhuman conflict. In our work and planning and discussion, our main principle is that separation between peoples is not a solution for any of the problems that divide peoples. And certainly ignorance of the other provides no help whatever. Cooperation and coexistence of the kind that music lived as we have lived, performed, shared, and loved it together, might be.
That's Edward Said speaking in 2003. We now skip ahead to a portion of the talk where he addressed the notion of a clash of civilizations or cultures.
The second problem is the one concerning the clash between two different peoples, two different cultures. Cultures, peoples, and civilizations are not watertight, inert, unchanging things. Exactly the opposite is true. And if there is such a thing as culture or nationhood at all, it is that each is and always will be enmeshed, constantly interacting and intertwined with other cultures and nations. Allowing for differences in kind, countries and peoples cannot really be separate and stand apart from their environment. It was historically one of the failures of British imperialism that in the Indian subcontinent, in Palestine, in Cyprus, in Africa, and even in Ireland, that it adopted the practice of partition, or as it has been called, divide and quit, thereby leaving matters worse off than before separation. Building walls, therefore, are a kind of folly that ought to be exposed exactly for what they are, namely a delusion that neither can be made fully to work in theory or in practice. Ignorance of the other is not a strategy for survival. All nationalisms, at their most feverish and embattled, fail this crucial test of awareness, a failure by no means limited to so-called underdeveloped or fanatical ideologies, cultures, or religions. Historically, Palestine is a palimpsest of an enormous number of peoples and civilizations, each of them leaving traces and effects that have lasted for many centuries. It must be said again and again that everything we know about ancient Palestine, for instance, speaks to a rich multiplicity of peoples and tribes, not just of Israelites, but of Canaanites, Philistines, Jebusites, Moabites, and many others. To extrapolate from that and say only one people, that only one people dominated and is therefore entitled to lay exclusive claim to Palestine today, that is simply a tragic misinterpretation and betrayal of something far richer and interesting. One can therefore interpret that history inclusively, giving rise to complexity and universalism, or far more narrowly as the exclusive possession of only one people and culture who prefer unending war against others to mutual recognition and coexistence. Civil wars are much more bitter and unyielding than any other kind. I think that's the essence of the problem we face today. Namely, whether, as some believe, Palestine ought to become and thereafter remain the principal homeland of just one dominant people, or whether it can become the homeland of the people who actually live there, regardless of race and religion, even though for the time being they are locked in mortal combat.
Edward Said, the Palestinian-American scholar and writer, speaking at UC Berkeley in 2003. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA radio. And Said's voice and Howard Zinn's and dozens of others are part of a curated compilation called Voices That Change the World, which features more than 1,300 hours of talks and debates and radio documentaries and performances and recordings and even on-air book readings. More than 1,300 hours on one USB drive. It's a 64-gig USB drive, I guess, synonym. Yours for a pledge of $200 or more to KPFA. A pledge of $200 or more to KPFA gets you this USB drive with all this material. And on the drive, you will hear, you will find some of the most important principled and social justice focused thinkers and writers and activists in U.S. history. So this is the largest and most comprehensive collection of historic audio ever compiled by the Pacifica Radio Archives. And it's an incredibly high-value thank you gift because we're asking for a pledge of $200 for 1,300 hours, 1,300-plus hours of talks and debates and performances. The phone number, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And you can also break this $200 pledge down into six equal monthly installments. And they come out to, I think I might have gotten it wrong before, it comes out to about $33 and change per month over a period of 6 months. So $33 and change per month over 6 months. And you get this magisterial, unparalleled historic audio compilation called Voices That Change the World from the Pacifica Radio Archives. The voices on this USB drive include those of Noam Chomsky, Alice Walker, Allen Ginsberg, Adrienne Rich, Gore Vidal, Langston Hughes, Jessica Mitford, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Murray Bookchin, Malcolm X, Huey Newton, Rosa Parks, Lily Tomlin, Emma Goldman, Billie Holiday, John Coltrane. I think in some cases we're talking about music performances. I wasn't able to listen to all 1,300 hours. We've got the voices of Fidel Castro, Russell Means, Philip Agee, Gary Snyder, Ed Asner, Toni Morrison, D.T. Suzuki. There's Alan Watts on this compilation, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Ray Kurzweil. It goes on and on, folks. And I think I figured out that 1,300 hours equals, like, if you listened 24 hours a day to this, it would take you over 50 days to listen to the entire compilation. And I think I also figured that if you listen to this 4 hours a day, it would take you more than 325 days to listen to this entire 1,300-plus-hour audio collection. Amazing. This is as high value as we get in terms of thank you gifts here. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. This is truly U.S. history. This is truly a history of dissent. This is truly an attack on ignorance in all forms that leads us down so many dangerous political paths, social paths, environmental paths. And you get all these agitators and dissenters, all these people who spoke truth to power, who sang truth to power, who rapped truth to power. You get all these people, dozens and dozens of them, on this USB drive, Voices That Change the World. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. And I want to go now to another clip, and it's a voice on Voices That Change the World. This voice belonging to Molly Ivins, well known for her sharp, satirical, and often hilarious political commentary. For several decades, Ivins lived and worked in Texas, writing for publications like the Texas Observer and the Dallas Times-Herald. Her syndicated column appeared in several hundred newspapers nationwide. Here's Molly Ivins trying to cheer up an audience in Berkeley in 2004.
One reason you should feel better right away is because you don't have to be in Texas. My governor is a guy named Good Hair Perry. That man has a head of hair every Texan can be proud of, regardless of party. A couple of summers ago, Good Hair needed to appoint a new member of the Public Utilities Commission. As y'all remember here and know very well here in California, that can turn out to be a critical public body. So Good Hair selected for this purpose a former Enron executive. The next day, Goodyear got a $25,000 check from Ken Lay. Those with suspicious minds thought there might be a connection. Goodyear was forced to hold a press conference where he explained to everybody's total satisfaction that it was completely coincidental. Now, in Texas, we do not have a sunshine law. We have sort of a partly cloudy law. But even in Texas, if you get a major state appointment like that, you have to fill out a bunch of forms and all your finances, and all this becomes part of the public record. So the Enron executive's forms showed up a couple of days later. Some minion from the governor's office brought them around to the press room where the alert guardian watchdogs of democracy were in action. And I started looking at the form, and somebody said, I don't know, you think 17 looks funny? Gee, I don't know, Sam, you think 17 looks funny? We all thought 17 looked funny. That was the question you have to answer about whether or not you've ever had any unfortunate involvement with law enforcement authorities. The governor's office had whited out the answers to question 17. This was a very sophisticated cover-up. We in the press corps are hard to fool. We were on the trail and discovered in no time flat that the citizen had had a couple of minor brushes with minor traffic violations. And also, while out hunting the year before, he had accidentally shot a whooping crane. And then he accidentally buried the whooping crane. I'm not making this up. And as a result, I had to pay a $15,000 fine under what in Texas is known as the Endangered Species Law. And we all thought that was damn stiff. And we put all this in the newspapers, and of course Texas is full of hunters. And their reaction was, well, hell, anybody could accidentally hit a whooper. We stayed on the story, and the next day we were able to report that he hit the whooper while on a duck hunt. Now, we got a whole staple of hunters. Now, you know, The whooping crane is 5 feet tall. It's a very large bird. The duck... Now we got a whole state full of hunters saying, you know, if this sumbitch too dumb to steal a whooper from a duck, he shouldn't be running state utilities. Forced to resign. My friends, progress can be made in many different and wonderful ways. Well, the great excitement at home, of course, is we've just had some political indictments. And three of the top fundraisers for Tom DeLay were all indicted. But they were indicted for breaking Texas campaign finance laws. You have to understand the magnitude of that achievement. We don't have any campaign finance laws in Texas. I mean, you really have to work at it to get indicted for that. And so we're all real proud of them. And we think this case may eventually lead to other indictments. And among those prominently mentioned in the indictable category is the incumbent Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives, a fellow named Tom Craddock. Now, I don't have anything against Tom Craddock personally. I don't like his politics, but I don't wish him ill. However, I am rooting for his indictment just as a matter of Texas political tradition. Should Craddock be indicted, that would make 6 out of the last 7 House speakers indicted for one thing or another. Now, there was one in that 6, I have to admit, who kind of broke the string. He was not indicted. He was the one who was shot to death by his wife. She was indicted but not convicted. Because in Texas, we recognize public service when we see it.
The late Molly Ivins, syndicated columnist, satirist extraordinaire, and author of Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She? Among other books, speaking in Berkeley in 2004. She is a very small part of a collection of talks and other presentations amounting to more than 1,300 hours on a compilation. It's called Voices That Change the World, and you can get that by going to kpfa.org and pledging $200 or more to KPFA, to listener-supported KPFA, to a radio station that really needs your help, comes to you several times a year so that we can continue to operate and bring you voices like Molly Ivins. And you can call instead if you want. You can make a toll-free call to 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can call and ask for this Voices That Change the World on USB drive. It's a compilation, 1,300 plus hours, and you can break it down into 6 equal monthly installments if you would like to do that. You can get a basic membership to KPFA. That's just a $25 a year pledge. There are other thank you gifts on offer if you want to pledge less than $200. Or if you want another thank you gift, some alternative thank you gift, go to kpfa.org. Or again, give us a call at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And I just want to encourage people to get this collection. I wish I could describe it. I wish I could. In fact, I printed out an Excel spreadsheet of all of the items, the recordings, the documentaries, the performances, the presentations on this Voices That Change the World. And the printer wouldn't stop printing, even though I had it doing double-sided printing. So it got up to page 49. And on 49, you have, for example, Muhammad Ali. You have Daniel Berrigan. You have Joan Baez, you have Dolores Huerta, and on page 48, you have a documentary about the Watts Rebellion, the 50th anniversary. You have Jimi Hendrix, you have Dorothy Day, you have Andy Warhol, you have Francis Ford Coppola, you have Anais Nin, you have Glenn Gould, the pianist. On page 46, you have Michael Shermer, you have Ray Kurzweil, you have Daniel Dennett and Steven Pinker. You have Lester Brown. On page 44, you have D.T. Suzuki. You have Why I Am an Atheist by Madeline Murray O'Hare. You have Russell Means on Native American Spiritual Values. You have a performance of the Trojan Horse. On page 42, you have classical guitar with Bill Matthews. You have the Philidor Trio giving a performance. You have Dave Bromberg. You have, I mean, it just goes on and on. You have a Mary Baraka on the next page. You have Paul Newman and John Cassavetes. The culture, the politics, the environmental critique, the feminist critique, the radical political critique is just amazing. And I want to offer this to you. I want you to have this 1,300-plus-hour compilation from Pacifica Radio Archives, Voices That Change the World, $200 pledge. If you want value, if you want a thank you gift that embodies value, if you get value from KPFA and from Against the Grain, and you want value in return, well, you can't really do better than this incredibly high-value thank you gift, Voices That Change the World. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Let's go now to another clip from Voices That Change the World. This was an on-air book reading of 1984, George Orwell's famous dystopian novel. Sales of 1984 surged after Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway used the phrase alternative facts in an interview. Here's just a sampling of this book reading. The reader is Charles Morgan.
O'Brien was looking down at him speculatively. More than ever, he had the air of a teacher taking pains with a wayward but promising child. There is a party slogan dealing with the control of the past. Repeat it, if you please. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. Winston repeated it obediently. Who controls the present controls the past, said O'Brien, nodding his head with slow approval. Is it your opinion, Winston, that the past has real existence? Again, the feeling of helplessness descended upon Winston. His eyes flitted toward the dial. He not only did not know whether yes or no was the answer that would save him from pain, he did not even know which answer he believed to be the true one. O'Brien smiled faintly. You are no metaphysician, Winston. Until this moment, you had never considered what is meant by existence. I will put it more precisely. Does the past exist concretely in space? Is there somewhere or other a place, a world of solid objects where the past is still happening? No. Then where does the past exist, if at all? In records. It's written down. In records. And in the mind, in human memories. In memory. Very well, then. We, the party, control all records. And we control all memories. And then we control the past, do we not? But how can you stop people remembering things, cried Winston, again momentarily forgetting the dial. It's involuntary. It is outside oneself. How can you control memory? You've not controlled mine. O'Brien's manner grew stern again. He laid his hand on the dial. On the contrary, he said, you have not controlled it. That is what has brought you here. You are here because you have failed in humility, in self-discipline. You would not make the act of submission, which is the price of sanity. You preferred to be a lunatic, a minority of one. Only the disciplined mind can see reality, Winston. You believe that reality is something objective, external, existing in its own right. You also believe that the nature of reality is self-evident. When you delude yourself into thinking that you see something, you assume that everyone else sees the same thing as you. But I tell you, Winston, that reality is not external. Reality exists in the human mind and nowhere else. Not in the individual mind, which can make mistakes and in any case soon perishes. Only in the mind of the party, which is collective and immortal. And whatever the party holds to be truth is truth. It is impossible to see reality except by looking through the eyes of the party. That is the fact that you have got to relearn, Winston. It needs an act of self-destruction, an effort of the will. You must humble yourself before you can become sane.
That's Charles Morgan reading from George Orwell's famous novel 1984. Charles Morgan was a programmer at KPFK, Pacifica radio station KPFK in Los Angeles. That recording was in 1975, I believe. And I'm C.S. Song. I'm alongside Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on listener-supported KPFA. And we are in the second day of KPFA's winter fund drive, winter 2017 fund drive. And it's been raining outside, maybe not today, but it's been raining a lot, and we would like to have it rain in here in the form of phone calls to support KPFA. Phone calls to support KPFA and phone calls to get an incredible amount of support for your development, your intellectual development, your, in some cases, spiritual development, your musical development, your cultural development, because we've got voices that change the world on USB, on one USB drive, and it is yours for a $200 or more pledge to KPFA, to listener-sponsored KPFA. If you haven't heard material like this before, if you haven't heard voices like this, or if you haven't heard, for example, on Against the Grain, you hear a lot of voices. If you've just never heard of these people before, but you find them wonderful and insightful and enlightening and worth discussing and worth pondering their ideas, then you get dozens and dozens of both famous and not so famous speakers and commentators and artists and performers and musicians on this 1,300-plus-hour compilation. It's called Voices That Change the World, and it is yours for a $200 pledge, which, again, you can break down into six monthly installments, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. It's also available online. You can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. And if you click on the appropriate category, it's a USB drive, then you will find this listed there. And we have about 10 minutes left in this hour, and we've been given a match of $600 from Lydia in Santa Cruz. So one person, and, you know, if you want to give a large sum of money and have it be presented later this drive as a match, as a challenge to other listeners to Against the Grain, please call in with that match, and you can get this thank you gift if you pledge $200 or more. But Lydia has put up $600 conditionally. She wants to match you dollar for dollar, but only until the end of this hour. And if we don't make $600 collectively from all of you out there, then Lydia will not match your $600. So your dollars are doubled, but only for 10 minutes. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. Imagine if you could pick out, the very best commentary and analysis and performance that you've ever heard on KPFA or could ever hear on KPFA, and you had it all in your hand to listen to whenever you liked and in whatever order you wanted. Now imagine that someone else has done it, has gone through KPFA's programming for the most penetrating, the most notable, the most historic material. That is what has happened. And in fact, it's gone beyond that because they've gone through our four Pacifica radio station sister stations and done the same. So the result is this 1,300-plus hour audio compilation that includes, as I mentioned, voices like Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn and Alice Walker and Allen Ginsberg and Langston Hughes and Paul Robeson and Billie Holiday and Emma Goodman and on and on and on. I don't have time to lay out all of the different speakers and presentations, and your dollars are doubled. It's a great time to call 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. And if you're wondering, well, you know, this is all history. You know, this is all stuff in the past. This doesn't have any relation to what's going on now. I'd like to play for you now something that James Baldwin said during the Nixon era. And let's hear a very, very short clip from James Baldwin.
There's a sense in which it can be said that the present administration is almost a very fortunate thing, because at least there is no way to be fooled by it. No, you certainly can't have any doubts about where you stand. And if you know that, then you have some idea of what you have to withstand and what you have to do.
James Baldwin, part of this Voices That Change the World collection on a USB drive, 64 gigabytes of amazing material, historic material, in unprecedented quantity from Pacifica Radio Archives. It's a $200 pledge to KPFA. Please give us a call, 1-800-439-5732.
1-800-439-5732 is easy to remember as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Click on the support link and then click on USB drives, and that's where you will find this, Voices That Change the World. And actually, that is the most cost-effective way to pledge to KPFA, because we get your money with the least cost to us. I guess that's a sort of circular explanation, but you know, I think you follow me. It would be wonderful to have a whole number of you pledge that way, too. Also, if you are put on hold, that's a way to just expedite your pledge. 1-800-439-5732, of course, is still a fantastic way to call. It's really hard to know how to describe this thank you gift, and CS has been doing a commendable job during this hour, but it's sort of mind-blowing that there is so much audio on this one USB drive. If that sounds almost overwhelming to you, don't let it do that, because you can just pick and choose what you want, but you can also think about, you know, if you want going on a long car trip, think about listening to the incredible radio arts. You just heard a little bit of the Orwell reading, so fantastically done, and there's so much of that. And this is the history of social movements over more than a half a century. This is the history of civil rights and the women's movement over half a century. This is the history of avant-garde art and music over the last half century plus. It is just mind-blowing. And we often talk about how there is are ruptures between how different generations understand the left, that people don't communicate enough between the generations. Well, this is the embodiment of so much history. It is a wonderful thing that you might want to subscribe to for yourself and maybe get another for a younger person. An incalculable value. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or kpfa.org. And for in the next 5 minutes that we have left, if you're able to pledge, Lydia in Santa Cruz will match you dollar for dollar. So please do what you can and do it right now. KPFA.org, 1-800-439-5732. No better value could I even think of beyond this radio station. It just is mind-blowing.
And you get your dollars doubled, as Sasha said. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Critical perspectives galore. And a lot of people are, you know, let's face it, a lot of people find it easier to listen than to read. Okay, well, you know, I understand that. I love to do both. But if you want to ingest a lot of material without reading a large tome, without going through books and books of stuff, and really this material is equivalent of dozens and dozens of books, but again, this is a curated collection, then get this USB drive. Get your dollars doubled by Lydia in Santa Cruz. We've only got 4 minutes left to make this match of $600. That means people going to their phone and pledging any amount. But if you want to pledge $200 or you can pledge $200 or more, give us a call, and you can do that as well. But give us a call in any case, 1-800-439-5732. You know, Howard Zinn earlier was saying when people stop obeying, the system can't sustain itself. And the way people stop obeying is via organizing. And, you know, I've been thinking about KPFA's role, and if you know, KPFA is a kind of organizer. It's a kind of meta-organizer. It organizes information. It organizes resources. It brings people together, and it organizes activism. It presents social movements. It presents activists. It presents scholars talking about activism. It helps people organize their thoughts, their analysis, come up with an analysis. How many times have we heard that where people are like, well, you know, what do we do with this information? And people say, well, you need an analysis. You need a structural analysis. You need to understand the system. 1-800-439-5732 is your way to get just an incredible amount of analysis, an analysis of the current moment, an analysis of past moments, an analysis that provides parallels between the past and the present as we look toward the future. 1-800-439-5732. $200 or more gets you this. Voices That Change the World. Sasha and I can't do better than this in terms of offering you a thank you gift for your support, for what we do, for what Sasha does, for what I do 3 days a week on this program. We're thinking of you constantly as we put together these programs, and we hope you think of us in the manner of helping us once a year, at least once a year. 1-800-439-5732.
1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. You know, looking at the incredible breadth of this collection, Voices That Change the World, that comes from KPFA and Pacifica's almost 7 decades, it really strikes me, it's a kind of incredibly potent reminder of how vital it is to support KPFA's future. When you look back and think, what would these social movements, what would have happened if we didn't have any way to both preserve what people said, but also at the time disseminated it to other people who took action, what would have happened? And then looking into the future, what will happen now if there is no KPFA at a time where so much is happening? There is this really unbridled assault from the corporate right. What will the prospects for the left be without a KPFA? If that is something that puts some fear into your heart, then think about supporting KPFA right now. Think about supporting Against the Grain right now. And think about getting a magnificent thank you gift. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. We have less than 45 seconds to go to the top of the hour. $600 on the line.
We've got $50 to go. So that means any call, $50 or more. And if you want the $200 Voices That Change the World, you can ask for that. But any call, it's not too late. 1-800-439-5732. Literally $600 hangs in the balance. So your call of $50 or more actually earns us $600. So your dollars are not doubled. They are, you know, multiplied by 12. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. 1-800-439-5732.